And we're back.
Welcome to Pathfinder News, Reviews, and Interviews podcast. I'm Ryan Costello.
And I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param.
We have, I'm going to call him an intriguing guest today. We are not talking to a game designer. We are not talking to someone that's in the industry, but we are talking to somebody that is bringing role-playing games, tabletop games, to a new audience. And one of the reasons I'm especially excited about this is because when we talk about GMing, we often compare the role to being a director or a producer, a writer, a cinematographer, usually people on the creative side of media. But it's as much performance as it is creation, and a lot of that performance has to be improvised. And so our guest today will actually be performing at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, the biggest comedy festival in the world. He will be the GM for a show called The Dice of Destiny. Today with us is Mr. Jordan McRae.
Hello, everyone. Welcome.
That's not your regular voice. You're performing already.
That's my DM voice. I may or may not have ripped off the merchant from Resident Evil 4.
I've never had a DM voice. Lots of character voices, but never one dedicated to the GMing narrative.
Well, this one, it's not specific to every time I game. It's more just for the Dice of Destiny, because you have to keep the attention of like maybe 70-odd people in an audience instead of six people around the table who already start invested.
So it's more than just projecting your voice. You really need people to be focusing on you and nothing else that's going on.
Yeah, when I'm talking, I have to be loud and noticeable enough that they will stop to wait to hear the rulings and things like that.
Well, we are definitely going to be talking about that, but I'm kind of curious about your journey, because it is a big deal to be performing in the Just for Laughs Festival and to be performing effectively a live play session. That's kind of amazing. I'm actually jealous of you and this opportunity that you've basically chiseled for yourself. So how did you get there? What is your journey as a gamer and as an improv performer?
I've been playing video games since I was like three, but in terms of relevant gaming, I've been playing, like, started with D&D, that's the classic gateway drug, like maybe 12 years ago, started GMing maybe a year after that, played a whole bunch of stuff, DM'd a fair amount of it. Like D&D, Pathfinder, two different Star Wars formats, Fate, three different formats of Cthulhu, Little Fears, which is great if you want to give your players nightmares, Hunter the Vigil Vampire, like a whole bunch of them. And for the last 5 years or so, I've also been doing improv out of the Montreal Improv Theater. So when one of the producers at the theater came with, like, he wanted to talk to me about an idea. So we met and we talked about it. And what ended up happening was The Dice of Destiny. It's an improv show that started last August. We've had, I think, seven sessions, roughly monthly, skipping some, obviously. But then maybe a month ago, the creative director at Montreal Improv contacted everyone who has to do with the show, because Montreal Improv is an official Just for Laughs venue. And he was pitching some shows to pitch to Just for Laughs, and ours is one of them, and we were all completely on board. I believe that I was trying to maintain a certain level of decorum and not exhibit all the excitement that I was feeling in a Facebook message. I think I stuck it down to just like a handful of exclamation marks. Then everyone was in, he pitched it, they were in, and that's it. We got a Just for Laughs show.
That is really awesome. So there's a lot of intriguing things you've talked about here, and I do want to, we're going to go through them one at a time, and we're really going to dive into them, in order. So starting with your gaming, you mentioned that D&D was your gateway drug. What was it about D&D that attracted you?
I've always been a fan of fantasy. Some of the earliest series of books I remember reading that wasn't like Goosebumps that I read because it was in a library when I was 10, was R.A. Salvatore's Forgotten Realms series. So one of my friends who like worked at a thrift shop at the time is like, hey, I got this old book and like the rules, and it's like the same thing that you read all the time. And I'm like, yeah, of course I'm in. What can I do? I want to be a thing. I want to make, how do you make it? I want to see it now. To me, it was just a thing that I'd always kind of wanted to do, and now one of my friends is putting on a game.
So he was your first GM?
Yeah.
And how long into your career did you decide that you wanted to try GMing?
I'd say it was between a year and 2 years. I don't remember exactly, but it was pretty soon, because I've always had this problem when I'm playing where if I make a character, it's just my favorite idea of the 8 or 9 character ideas that I had bouncing around at the time. So if you GM, they can deal with all of those characters instead of just making the one.
And then were you creating stories whole cloth, or were you running from canned adventures?
I've never really ran, like as you called it, a canned adventure. I've taken, like I, not at the same one as my friend, but I've also worked at thrift stores, and I bought like an old map pack for like an AD&D desert setting. I took that, cannibalized all the maps, and then made up my own stuff to populate them, because I don't know, I wouldn't say my ideas are better, but my ideas are my ideas, and I'd rather say that it's mine. But I'm terrible at maps, so I will try to find a map or really abstract it if I have to make it myself.
Yeah, I am officially stealing they're my ideas and they're mine, which is a funny thing to steal, but yeah, I'm the same way, but I've never described it that way. I'm always like, oh, but my memory is bad, and I'm more creative than I am good at memorizing things and implementing somebody else's idea. But no, it's just like that. It's just my ideas are mine. That's my comfort zone. Mm. So I totally get what you're saying. Now, what about GMing as a performance? When, like, is this immediately that was your style, or was that something that slowly evolved?
I think it's definitely ramped up since I started to do improv. Because like I was GMing as a non-improviser for years beforehand. A lot of the time before, I was just trying to find characters that I thought were cool and hoping people would care about them. They would get personalities. I've never really been at all for scripting things. My characters, I've never once written out what my characters are going to say. I will put a bullet point for like what the information that they hold, and then I will try to find their voice. I think it just got more amusing once I had some level of training.
Now,
I was always amused. I was always amusing myself, but I think the others started enjoying it more after.
So was your DMing, was that influential in choosing to go into improv?
It's kind of weird. The two of them are kind of the same thing, where it's a thing that I already had interest in. It was less I decided to do it, and more I realized it was a possible thing that I could do, and I was immediately in. Like, as soon as D&D came up, I'm like, I am in. Then my friend, my same friend who was my gateway DM, started getting into improv, and I did one of their free workshops, and I immediately was like, no, this is my thing now. I want to do this. Sign me up.
Is there an end goal? Do you plan on making a career of this if you can?
Well, I mean, theoretically it would be nice, but improv is not the type of thing that a lot of people can make a career. You need to be like unbelievably huge for it to be worthwhile. A lot of improvisers, I think all of them that I know pretty much, have like day jobs as well. It's not like stand-up. It's easy. I mean, it's still nowhere near easy to make it as a stand-up, but you have a slightly better chance than as an improviser.
Yeah, I think people can picture stand-up as a career, whereas if you're an improviser, people can't even like visualize what that is as a day-to-day job.
Yeah, they can specifically picture it like Colin Mochrie or Ryan Stiles, or like the Who's Line crowd, but that's it. There's like 5 professional improvisers that people can think of, and one of them is Drew Carey, and he's not very good.
I mean, I'm not going to argue. I'm just surprised. Speaking of stand-up comics, I know how stand-up comics train. I've read about the process of being a stand-up comic, but how do you train to improvise better?
Well, it's definitely a process. At the beginning, they don't so much care what you're saying. Like at the very beginning, they just want to make sure that you are saying things that you feel comfortable in expressing yourself. Then they kind of start to add like rules on, like depending on the theater you're at, maybe try not to offend anyone too greatly. I've seen some lower level scenes in workshops, thankfully never on stage, where it's like, oh, that should not have happened in front of people. I'm glad it didn't. Mm-hmm. Or like building scenes that make sense, like establishing relationships and where you are, so that people are on the same page instead of just you are two voices in a void. And then like it starts building with more complicated things, like finding fun and building it naturally instead of just trying to crack jokes, because improv where you're just trying to crack jokes is just stand up but with insecurity, because you have a friend on stage if you screw up. And then once you get past like a certain level, they kind of slowly start saying those rules that we taught you aren't always true. Now that you're at a certain level, like you maybe don't always need to agree and expand what your friend says. Maybe it's a stronger offer to like disagree and like have your character not mirror theirs, but like grow friction. Because like the number one rule of improv is the yes and, which is like take what they say and add on to it. Don't tell them no. Like the most basic thing, if you offer me a muffin, I will take it and declare that it was a blueberry muffin and it's my favorite and thank you. Because if I just say, yes, it is a muffin, I'm giving you nothing.
Or that's not a muffin.
Oh, that is the very worst thing. And as soon as anyone does that, any improviser cringes inside because that's you've immediately destroyed the reality of your scene. It's like the D&D equivalent would be like the Lich pulling out a smartphone and taking a selfie.
Well, we definitely don't want to have that. Now, Starfinder, we're all on board with Lich selfies. I think there's like a whole dedicated subforum dedicated to it. But no, not in Pathfinder at all.
That's a space Lich. It's completely different, pair.
Now, this is a lot of GM. Like I've attended like a billion, and I'm terrible at it. Okay, I'm absolutely terrible at it. But I've attended like not a billion, but like five or six different like improvising for GMs, etc., to make your games better, etc. Have you had cross skills? I mean, has this helped each other? I mean, are you bringing? I mean, you're bringing the game to the stage, so I know it's helping you there. But like, how much has this grown you as a GM to participate in and learn these improv lessons?
Well, I think it helps a lot. Depending on your style, there may be some people where it would help them a little bit less. But for me, I was always the type of person who didn't want to overplan. Like, I would front load campaigns, like write a whole bunch of backstory, and then just kind of pull story threads and things almost sporadically after that, like once I built the world. Like it makes you better at, because everyone has that thing where this character knows all of this stuff and then your player has a weird mind and they're like, oh, but what about this incredibly awkward solution? And it's like, oh, I didn't think of that. Oh, what did I do? Improv will help you come up with a reason why what they said either is a great idea and let's see what you can do to make sure that they regret bringing it up, or like maybe a plausible reason why that would not work. Because another big part of improv is justification. Like if your partner comes at you holding a chainsaw and you're miming brushing your teeth, why is that happening? Like, is it just that you maybe got the demolition day wrong and you thought you had a calm bathroom day? Like there's a million possible things that it could happen, but that ability to like, no, that bridge wouldn't work because don't you remember this happened with the trolls? They're swarming it now. Or like just something like pulling something from what you've already given instead of trying to make up a whole new bull reason to that they don't believe or like. They start making like little railroad noises because they were like, oh, no, the GM only has one plan. You have to go there.
Yeah, you're reminding me. One time I caught a GM with his pants down. Basically, like we were sent on a mission. We did the whole mission, and then we got to a point where we couldn't proceed. And the guy who sent us on the mission was like, "We'll send in the army now." And we were like, "Why didn't you just send in the army to begin with?" And he was like, you know.
I'm so grateful my players just every so often go, "Oh, there's the tracks. Let's get on."
Yeah, improv, I think the other major thing that it's helped is coming up with interesting characters that the players want to interact with, not because they give good quest rewards or because they gave them good information, but just because they find them amusing.
Yep. I am also familiar with that. I once had a housekeeper that was everybody's favorite NPC, and it meant that people were just staying at one of the PC's houses. You can't, like, have the wise old elder sitting in the corner of a guy's house. So it's like, how am I going to get the adventure to them when all they want to do is talk to the housekeeper? So eventually they left the house, and that's when I jumped them. I had to throw every hook at them right away because it's like, they're free. They're out. Finally, this is my chance.
Now, you've mentioned that you really like making characters and personalities. How do you come up with how do you base your characters? How do you come up with these personalities for your games and on stage?
Well, for the, like, if it's a character that I'm building as a player, I normally put a lot more time into it. Like, I think of, it's kind of like a logical chain. Like, this character is, what's the last guy? Like, I am playing a Tiefling Magus, except I want to be chaotic good. Why is he chaotic good? Because he hates his family and they were lawful evil and he's just doing it to be contrary. Why is he doing that? because he resented his father for leaving without him, and his mother didn't really care because he looks too much like his dad's demonic side of the family. And it's just so on and so forth. Like, it ended up with a character who was being a good guy, but out of spite. Like, he was sometimes rather sadistic. Like, oh, I mean, I am doing the good thing. I am killing the bad guys, but oh, I am setting them on fire in their tents. If it's as a GM, I normally try to... There's a couple of characters that I hope that they're going to like that I will normally put a little more effort into. But the other is that, I mean, sometimes it just happens because the voice I make when they happen to run across them kind of lends itself a certain way. If it's a voice that hurts my throat, for instance, their character is not going to talk a lot. Or like, I will take every character at the very base could be described in like two words, like gnome, illusionist, human, fighter. Take that and then either give them the most stereotypical or the most opposite personality you can get. Like a human fighter with like a huge amount of strength and massive like blood-stained armor who just happens to be like a fop who hates getting stained himself, but he likes the blood on his armor because it makes him look butch. Or like a little gnome illusionist who's 2 feet tall but with a real chip on his shoulder, and he will punch you right where you don't want to be punched if you try to push him a little too far.
Wow, a punchy illusionist.
Well, I mean, he's at a good height where you don't want him to punch you.
Fair.
Well, that's what
I'm really interested in what you were saying about...
Sorry.
I'm really intrigued. Like, I enjoy how you were explaining things, because you'll often hear people, like, they'll almost make fun of the idea of what is a character's motivation. Like, it's almost a cliche of theater and performance art. But you reversed it. You were like, if I'm making a backstory, I ask why, which is the same thing as what is the motivation. But it's like, instead of just saying what... Say what and then ask yourself why. And you just like were creating a character with more and more depth just by challenging yourself to justify every part of their backstory.
Well, it's I didn't really think of it at the when I'm doing it, but it's kind of another improv thing. It's another phrase like, if this is true, what else is true?
Interesting. I don't like, know if that you, one. How does that work?
Well, if you start a scene with a character that, since it's improv, you haven't really built them, but your first offer is something that's a little weird. Like your scene partner offers you a sandwich and you decide that your response to this is to cross your arms, turn away and say, don't give me that line. It's like, oh, okay, obviously we're fighting. Judging on how we delivered that, we're probably married or dating. Now, I'm in a bad mood and they don't think it's true. If that's true, what else is true? Maybe they were drunk yesterday or last night and so drunk that they don't necessarily remember. If that was true, what else is true? I'm really angry. It's probably not the first time. If it's not the first time, but they're still doing this, they don't even see that it's a problem. And then that makes me more angry because not only are they a habitual drunk in my head, despite the fact that we've only had one line each, but they don't even see it as a problem.
And they're not even aware that this is the stuff going on in your head. So then how do you convey these thoughts?
Well, I mean, once you have a decent buildup, you can give them a line. Like if their response is like, well, you don't want a sandwich today? And it's like, oh, come on, this is the third time this week you've been home stinking of rye. Okay, leave me alone. Like, give them a line that spells it out, because vagueness is no one's friend at improv.
Do they smell of rye bread or rye gin?
Rye whiskey.
Rye whiskey, okay.
I think it's whiskey.
I don't know my booze, but I do know my sandwiches. And if you were going for a pun there, I applaud you.
I normally like puns, but that one was unintentional, because the first... alcohol that came to mind, despite the fact that I don't think I've ever actually had rye.
So a lot of what you're talking about are rules that everyone involved in the improv knows, and that's something that we'll obviously see a lot of at the Dice of Destiny. But what about at a game table? If the players don't know the rules, they don't know the structure of their responses, how do you guide them as the GM to continue an improv session?
Well, it's a couple of things. It's helpful having like a bit of an improv background, because another thing that about improv is that if your audience is giving you nothing, everyone's having a terrible time. Like, yep. You kind of build on the energy from the crowd. You kind of read the room. It kind of helps if you have six people around the table and you're bringing stuff up, and like maybe that person is distracted. That person looks like they'd rather be on their phone, but like you have these three. You find, okay, they really like this character. Make a mental note. Maybe this character has information for them later down the road. And in general, I find, at least with my players, that as long as they're having fun, they will continue to do the thing that makes them have fun. So if they have a character that they like, or if they have a setting that they like, they will continue to approve of those things and go farther with it.
Go on.
And to me, like the joy of having, like, I don't want to say no preparation, because I definitely have prep for my sessions, but like a little less than what many would deem wise, is that it's not just about guiding them the way they have to go, because yes, that noble is the only person who has the information, but the only person who knows that the only person who has the information is the noble is me. And if they don't want to get to him, and I don't want to spend an hour with them running around and getting nothing, maybe this guy that they find much more interesting can point them towards the information instead. Like, I don't like GMing as I have written it down, and therefore that is the only way that it can happen. Until they've seen me say something, if I decide there's a better way to do it, that thing I wrote down, forget that. That didn't happen. I'm going to cross it over and say the fun guy over there has an arrow that he can point at them or something. And like reading the room and saying, oh, they don't really care about this subplot, but they do need the information from that subplot. Maybe there's another subplot that's like, try to bend that thing that they had to do with something else that they want to do and try to find somewhere in the middle.
No. There's something that really interested me in how you began answering that question. And that is, you were saying, what if somebody's on the phone? Most GMs will then obsess about that one person and try and drag them out. But your answer was focus on the other players at the table and like create energy in the room. And it's like, oh, that's how you get the player off the phone. You make it fun for everyone else and they will join in. You have to make everything else more interesting than the phone, instead of just reminding them they're being rude and then nobody's having fun. Then it's just a lecture.
No one likes to be either shamed or overly enthused at in a sarcastic fashion. But it's harder to want to ignore the conversation when it's obvious that like the DM and half the party are having a lot of fun with this.
That is good advice.
Well, the carrot's nice until you need the stick.
I think that's the opposite of what we were getting at, but also a valuable lesson, Para.
But even, I mean, you're talking about like, you're not talking about punishing the characters, right? You're talking about punishing the players when they're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of like shaming them about not paying attention, or just making the focus on them. And it's like, this guy's not paying attention. I need to make sure he pays attention. But really, no, you don't.
I mean, unless it's possible that they're just having an awful day, in which case everyone has an awful day every once in a while. I know I've DM'd through awful days. You kind of don't have a choice but to be engaged on those. But if you have a player that's not paying attention, the fault is not 100% with that person. It means that as a DM, you could have done more to engage that person as well, unless they're new to the group and they're just awful and you don't like them and you don't know that yet. But my group, we've been playing together for years, so I know that I am capable of engaging all these people if I'm doing it right. So if they're not paying attention, either they're having a terrible day or maybe I'm not doing it right and I need to do something different.
Well, I think I have, and I know we have on the podcast, always been a strong advocate of not using in-game solutions for interpersonal problems and addressing the real issue politely and discreetly, as opposed to public shaming and loud amounts of drama.
So I didn't catch the end of that sentence. It kind of cut out.
Oh, okay. I said as opposed to loud shaming and then large amounts of drama.
Yeah, I haven't really done much of the player shaming. When we first started, we used to have like an in-joke where we would give the character who wasn't paying attention a magically embarrassing but not stat-reflecting like magical infection or illness.
Oh, I tried that, but then all my players tried to get it. Like, oh, his one if his ears turned pointed, let's see what happens if I get try it. Like, they just, like, pile on to earn all the terribleness.
Mm. I mean, we specifically used to call it magical herpes.
Oh.
With no, like, there was never any evidence of this so much as it just, your character has this now. It's not, like, a fun thing to have, and there's no physical thing, so no one else wanted it. Yeah, it was just like
a scarlet letter.
Yeah, it's like the DM has disapproved of your actions, but because this game is supposed to be fair, there's no actual mechanical, like, penalty for this. It's just, here, you have your I'm annoyed with you sticker for the session.
I had a GM who used to give out wrath points. He never cashed them in. They never did anything, but you never wanted to get a wrath point.
You think he had like in his head a method where after you get like past 20, the rocks just fall on you?
It's very possible that he had a whole like just system of things that were happening and like just effects behind the scenes were plinkling out of our control. And we were just like, wrath points.
This is all like harkening back to permanent records and bad lessons school teachers use to keep unruly children in line.
I might threaten my player that this behavior is going on their permanent RPG record.
You're also...
So we've been talking a lot about... Go ahead.
I said, you also have had a habit of using candy as rewards for sessions, too, so...
Me?
Not you?
I do not give candy as rewards.
Oh, now I'm disappointed.
I don't want stickiness at my table. So we've been talking a lot about the improv and the performance side of GMing, but a lot of improv is also about humor and comedy. So first of all, why is that? Why are those two so married?
I mean, it's possible to make it a dramatic improvised scene as well, but normally if you're making it up on the fly, people are going to look like they're having fun doing it, and it's a lot easier to be accidentally funny than it is to be accidentally narratively fulfilling and dramatic and like clever in that way. Like an improv scene is much more likely to devolve into something where you end the scene because people are laughing too hard in the scene and hopefully in the audience than it is to be like, oh, you made a really good point about the pointless list of human life. I felt something. Next scene, please. Like it's just, it lends itself a lot more as a thing where you're making things up and having fun at the time to comedy than anything else.
I mean, I just laughed at the pointlessness of life, so it must be really hard to have like improvised drama that's engaging. I'd imagine even on the super ego part of it, because you can appreciate comedy on multiple levels, but drama is really like the emotional level. The more you're thinking about it, the less interesting it is. And yeah, improv is all about appreciating it on multiple levels.
But at the same time, most improvisers I've talked to agree that yes, the laugh feels amazing, but the occasional time when you can get like the shocked or concerned gasp about your character feels so much better because it's so much harder. Just on stage, you're like, oh, they're not just laughing at the scene. They actually care about where I'm going through right now. This is amazing. And then the next line always makes them crack because they're all serious. And then the next person makes a fart joke or something. Hopefully not a fart joke, because after a while those get old. But like, there are dramatic moments, but it's really hard to make people care in that way for even like a 5-minute set, let alone like a 20. And the Dice of Destiny is an hour. So we definitely have to be comedic.
But at the same time, like, normally people are going to an improv show, I guess, with the expectation of comedy, but people won't necessarily be going to a fantasy storytelling improv show. Like, I think they would be a little more open to the idea of drama than they would in most improv situations.
One of kind of a great arrow in the quiver of improv is that deliberately being over dramatic is also a great tool for comedy.
Yes. Go on.
I don't have to try to be funny. I just have to try to be dramatic and just overshoot deliberately. I'm trying to think of an example from a past show.
Well, Captain Holt on Brooklyn Nine-Nine is the first idea that comes to mind when you explain that. He is hilariously serious.
I've never actually seen that show. It's on my list of things I have to see, but I've not seen it.
I love it so much.
It is good things.
All right. Let me see if I can think of another super serious. I guess, no. I was going to say... I was going to make a Simpsons reference, but no, it doesn't quite land. Param, can you think of any characters that are funny because they're just not funny ever?
Not on the spot. This is why I'm really bad at improv.
All right, fair enough. Jordan, are you familiar with My Little Pony?
I'm aware that it is a thing, that it's
okay,
had
so
three...
Pinkie Pie's sister, Maud. Very serious. Very funny. Look, see, Param, just the mention of Maud made Param laugh.
I'm just not
so
used
to... So there's
our
examples.
I'm just
Captain
not...
Holt and Maud.
So you mentioned your show is an hour long, and that's considered short for a role-playing session. Like, very, very short for a role-playing session, actually. But long for improv? Like, how has that proven to be difficult for you?
Not so much, actually. It always feels either just right or like we could have had an extra scene or two. But that's just because... Like this, it's specifically narrative improv, like where it's not just a bunch of sketchy scenes thrown together, where it's like a story that you follow for the entirety of it, because otherwise it would be a really terrible role-playing session. Like at the beginning, we introduce them, we figure out who their characters are going to be. They don't know before they start. They know nothing about what's going to happen at all, beyond like a couple of the rules of the show, but nothing about anything else. Then we go for about 25 minutes. There's an intermission where like the host comes back on and talks to them out of character to see how they think it's going. And then We have the other half that ends in like the big final encounter. For a narrative show, you almost never get an hour long to do it. Most narrative things are like 20 minutes and it feels either satisfying or rushed, but normally a little rushed. Having an hour is kind of a blessing, but I don't think this would ever go as long as a normal RPG session, just because there's almost no, there's very little rules and no stats. So it's not the type of thing where they would have to continuously be checking how to use all their abilities that they chose, so much as they have like three things that they're either good at or bad at, and they just want to do those as much or as little as they can. Ideally, as much of the thing that they're bad at as they can, because it's funny.
Well, so if there's very little rules and no stats, do the dice, the titular dice, come into play?
Yeah, we have, like, we roll, there's only one die that we roll a d20. Mm-hmm. And basically how it works is I will stop the action and I will tell them, like, oh, you said you have you are going to do this. Your character is blank, therefore you are either good or bad at that, or that idea is flipping crazy. Oh my God, you need at least this much on this dice. Like, I assign all the odds kind of on the fly based on how the character was built and how crazy what they're doing is. I've had characters who have tried to like spontaneously develop a new magic power that they did not have. Mm-hmm. And because it's improv, it's like, I'm not going to say that's impossible, but that's going to need a hell of a high roll. I've never seen that one work yet. Then you roll the die and then sometimes it's just pass fail. Sometimes it's if you don't pass, like if you pass here, you get everything. If you fail by less than five or less than whatever, you fail, but it's like no big consequence. If you fail a lot, you like pull the muscle or injured yourself severely, and or like you miss your shot so badly that you shoot your friend. Deal with it.
Now, this may be contrary to the notion of improv, but how many of your sessions end in TPKs then?
Well, I mean, never before the last scene, which kind of makes sense. They have not succeeded every quest, I will tell you that much.
So then how do you time it for to make sure a TPK doesn't happen early enough? Is it a matter of just never having a threat that big early on, or do you give them a few more chances early on and you start taking them away?
Well, I mean, ultimately it's it is me and there is one guy who is one of the best improvisers I've ever seen, who plays like all the NPCs.
All of them? So kind
of, yeah, all the NPCs. This guy is a ridiculous font of energy.
You know what? For a second I was impressed, but every GM plays every NPC. I don't know why that struck me as something. Wow, this guy does all the NPCs.
Yeah, but we play the NPCs from here. He's doing it standing on stage and acting out every single one. It's impressive to see. But like, and he also has like a gaming background as well. So between he and I, we kind of determine what the stakes are going to be. In general, I'm not and also with the roles, I tell them what the results are going to be if they fail. So I'm not, if it's 20 minutes in, I'm not going to say, if you fail this roll, you die. Like if they're trying to jump a gorge or something, over, it's not going to be over like spiky death rocks. It's going to be like over water. So now they have to deal with getting back to shore on land while being pursued, instead of, oh, you fall and you break your neck in 15 places and you're dead three times before you hit the ground. Like, since it's improv and there's no map and there's very few rules, we can kind of decide like, okay, this is not going to be a fatal problem. It's just going to be a very bad problem.
Now, you mentioned before that the setup is you as the game master, and then you have your friend who's doing the NPCs, but the two players are guests. How has that worked out for you? Just are most of them familiar with gaming at all, or are you spontaneously introducing them to both gaming and the concept of your story at the same time?
We've had a handful of people who have had like a fair amount, like I think one or two who had like a lot of D&D or Pathfinder. I don't know what system he plays, because I've not played with him, but like I can think of at least one, and I know I've had one or two more that have had like fairly extensive role-playing experience. Others who have played it like once, others who are like, what's a dragon? Like it's maybe not quite what's a dragon, but that's the level of RPG experience. We will normally like run them through the improv side of it, but not warn them at all about what's going to happen on the game side of it, because they're improvisers and they don't need to know. It's more fun if they don't.
But with
I guess you also can assume that your audience doesn't know. So even if everyone on the stage knows what, say, a bugbear is, you still need to describe a bugbear.
Yeah, like I can't just throw. If it's something really obvious, like it is a dragon, they'll know what a dragon looks like. It is a giant. It is a demon. Unless I want it to be a specific demon, I can just say it's like a big, tall demon. It has two legs. There you go. You know more or less what it looks like. Or like you pull from mythology. Like not everyone knows what a Glabrezu is or what a bugbear is. But I mean, most people will know what a harpy is. Or like not all the sessions we've done in the past have been fantasy. Some of them have been based off of like other worlds. So part of the fun of it was we did Lovecraftian once. Nice. And the point is, I didn't really know what they were facing. The NPC guy didn't know exactly what it was being. They didn't know what the thing looked like. It was unknowable. That was the point of it, which is so much easier in improv when you don't have to have a mini or a stat block. It's just like, it's a giant elephant-headed demon, and there's tentacles, and I'm going to say non-Euclidean, but I don't really know exactly how that works on a thing. But there you go.
So that answers another question I was about to have. So, especially with the players changing out, so there's not an overarching storyline that's passing through each of the games you're hosting?
No, each one is entirely separate. They're not, as I said before, they're not even all fantasy. More of them, I think, yeah, more of them have been fantasy than not, just barely. Like, the one that's coming up is going to be fantasy because it's what we're mostly known for. Since we're going to do it for Just for Laughs, we wanted to do what we were known for. But since it was a monthly show, we didn't want to keep doing, like, the same thing. So we've done, like, Lovecraftian suspense. We've done post-apocalyptic, like, sort of like Mad Max-ish, but with no infringing characters or concepts. Sort of like a sci-fi, but not so much Star Trek, more like a Firefly, like a subsistence level sci-fi, instead of we have a magic thing that makes everything we want, unless the plot says that thing doesn't work, in which case let's get crystals. I'm not a Star Trek fan.
But actually, that brings up something that I've noticed in a lot of improv shows that I've gone to, is that the audience tends to want just mashups of popular culture. So is that something that you bring in even like in referentially, or do you try and stay away from other people's property?
Oh, in improv, I like regular improv, I will make pop culture references, not all the time, but like often enough. But in the Dice of Destiny, I don't think it's really happened. Like the world is all kind of made up and then we continue as we go. So it's definitely possible, probably even probable, that at least one of, like, especially the post-apocalyptic wasteland thing, there was probably something a little closer to Mad Max adjacent than I would have liked in it. But in general, no, I try not to go like, oh, and you find four short dudes, an elf, a dwarf, a tall human, another human with a target painted on his back, and a wizard who is buzzed off somewhere and who's not to be found, so we can't fix all their problems. Like, I try not to reference anything like that.
Is that from a thing? That's from a thing, isn't it?
It's probably from a thing. Oh, and then eagles come up for no reason at the end.
How big are these eagles?
Big enough that they could have solved the problem by themselves right away.
So, I want to know, do you think, what are the dice and the what little bit of rules and randomization that you're bringing to it? What is that adding to the improv performance that you wouldn't have had without?
Well, it's a nice way to kind of randomize certain decisions, because it's one thing to go normally in an improvised fight scene between like the NPC, I'm going to say Mark because that's his name, and the hero. Well, I'm going to say hero because the heroes change. If the hero decides I'm going to attempt to stab Mark with my sword, it's then going to be like a negotiation between them physically on stage. Like, is this stab going to work? Is it going to be like a graze? Is it going to stab him through and then the fight is over? The dice kind of add a really neat dynamic of they don't know what's going to happen. They kind of have to freeze in place, wait for the dice and go, oh, it didn't hit. So then the way they're miming needs to deliberately be a failure, or Mark needs to block it. And also, the thing that I found, I thought it was going to be a bit of a factor when we started, but the audience, I realized this after we did it in front of an audience for the first time, the audience kind of goes into like an edge of your seat type of mode when the dice are rolling. Because we have like a, we have a projector set up to like a screen shared phone with a dice rolling app. And the dice aren't just like you press the button and the numbers come up. There's like a physical emulation of a die rolling. And the audience will like hold their breath waiting for the die to fall, especially if it's teetering between like a 2 and a 17 or something. I don't know if those are neither adjacent on a D20. I've not really examined mine recently. but like if it's between a definite pass and a definite fail, I have heard them, like every single person in the room, freak out and cheer when the dice both go really good and really bad. Because if the heroes are doing really well, or if one of them is doing really well and they fail, the audience loves it. you've made your last five rolls and now you can't move a boulder despite the fact that you're a paladin who's like 7.5 feet tall. Yes, you suffer. Whereas like you are a poor put upon like dagger wielding thief and you finally got a roll right. They love that too.
What were the two numbers you were asking if they were adjacent on a D20?
I think I said like 2 and 17.
2 and 18, 2 and 20. I don't know. 17's nowhere near it. I thought you said 2 and 18. I was going to give you kudos. You did not earn those kudos.
At least I'm honest. I could have just said 18.
What's the weird...
Yeah, I'd like to take this one, Brian. I was not expecting so much physicality that you described. I know you said that Mark, when he's playing the NPCs, gets physical, but I was still expecting this to mostly just be people sitting around a board, possibly with books. So this is like a full-on mimed performance that they pause and wait for you to tell them how to continue?
Oh yeah, this is a fully mimed... They're not actually role-playing the players really at all. They're playing the characters. If they're saying, I am going to attack the thing with my sword, it is going to be probably followed by a pause and a dice roll, followed by an attempt to attack something with a mimed sword. There are no books, there is no table. They can sit down, they're allowed that, but only if they're doing it as characters in scene. They're not doing it like as players sitting down and rolling die. The only person who has a die is me.
And like, do you the get whole to thing, sit the whole time?
Yes, but that's because the lighting doesn't work as well when I'm standing behind the table.
Now, you mentioned miming having a sword, so I'm taking it that the uniform does not include cloaks and wizard hats?
I do have a cloak and a hood. Because I am the DM, and when we concepted the show, I already happened to have owned a cloak because
yes.
worked at a thrift shop, and a cloak came in, and I'm like, why wouldn't I buy a cloak? It's a cloak. I will find uses for a cloak. But the others, it's like street clothes, like regular improv performances.
You know, a lot of sessions of our role-playing games have started with you find a cloak in a thrift shop. That's just a classic fantasy trope.
You mean like you're playing a D20 modern thing? It's like, oh, it's a magic cloak, and now you get to join the space elves to yes. fight a star lich or whatever you said like 45 minutes ago.
Exactly. It's not so much a cloak of destiny as much as it is a cloak of obligation, and it's yours now.
Mm. Well, down here in the South, I kind of get worried if anybody's bringing cloaks and hoods in the thrift shops.
Oh, no, in general, no one should be bringing a cloak to a thrift shop. This is a very mysterious situation.
Oh, this one doesn't have a hood, though. The hood is separate, and it's black. It's not... I mean, the cloak and hood you really want to worry about is white. This one's black, so it's cool.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, all right. So, let's talk about drama again. Actually, let's talk about the way you tell the story and the way you keep people engaged in the story while there's still a comedy performance going on, because... A lot of people will throw the story under the bus for the sake of humor.
Are you talking about more on like Dice of Destiny or more as a general GM thing?
Let's start with Dice of Destiny and then we'll broaden.
Well, Dice of Destiny is like there is a story that they are following to the end. But since it's an improv show, it is like more comedic than like a game playing session. So in general, like if funny is happening, you let funny happen. But sometimes... If they've gone too far afield, the audience also finds it really funny when you remind them, oh, hey, you have a quest to do. Why are you seducing this Trient? That has nothing to do with your quest. That makes no sense. Also, it's weird, and it's been 10 minutes. Please stop. or, like, reminding them, like, use language to remind them, like,
and just over that hill, in 24 hours, the mayor will be executed. Remember the mayor whose quest to rescue you are on. You are here in a field doing nothing. What do you do?
Like, you gotta have to start, like, pushing them a little bit eventually.
Is that seducing a treant example from a game? Is that personal experience?
It wasn't quite a treant, but it wasn't a race that makes sense, and I don't know how to describe it. The closest thing was a treant, but it was covered in like cucumbers and pickles and like other like vegetables and fruits and stuff. So it's like
kind of salad golem.
A treant was, but it was like a barky thing underneath it. So it was like a treant with a salad glued to it, kind of. I don't remember why it happened, but I do remember that it happened.
So what is the furthest afield that your groups have taken you during one of these?
It's not so much that they've gone super, super far afield. Oh, no, let me back that up. Once they have a quest, it's less that they are going afield from the quest so much as they are dilly-dallying like hell in the middle of the quest. Like, okay, we're two-thirds of the way through and you finally made it to the city that you needed to go to do the quest in. Please stop fighting with the guards. But I have had one session where they ended up not doing the quest I had planned for them to do at all, even from the word go, because of how the first scene went. Normally, like, a character will give them a quest because we don't want the players to have to make up everything. They don't know the system like we do. So normally in the first or second scene, we'll have someone like give them a quest, normally based somewhat on like how their characters are and somehow just a little bit of pre-planning for that one step. But like the first line out of one of my players' mouths ones were like, "We have to hurry, we're on a quest," before I told them anything. So I'm like, "Oh, you have a quest?" Then they didn't really have a quest, but then they ended up murdering an old man and getting kicked out of their shelter and then having to go on a Mad Max style adventure through the desert with no friends. So it kind of worked out as a quest in the end.
And you couldn't just shoehorn your quest in after that?
Well, I mean, the quest was to try to... my original quest for that session, I can spoil that now because that session happened months ago and it's not going to happen again. They were supposed to like find a new source of water for their rapidly drying city. But they don't really need a new source of water for a city that kicked them out and doesn't want them back because they murdered an elder. So yeah, it just became a general quest for a place where they can live without someone else trying to kill them.
All right, we are coming up on our hour. Where would you like to go from here, Jordan? Would you like to talk more gaming? Would you like to talk more improv?
I guess, like, since this is especially since it's a Pathfinder podcast, maybe more gaming than improv, I would think.
Mm-hmm. All right, so then let's talk about humor at the game table. There is a tendency, I believe, for most groups to incorporate a lot of humor. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on why that is, but like, how can you balance humor at the game table while also having like dramatic life or death moments and trying to tell an epic story?
Oh, I think that having characters that are kind of like any throwaway character can be 100% funny because they don't have to matter. Like, if it's an important character, they can still be funny, but try to give them, like, a quirk from a character in a sitcom and not a quirk from a character like an SNL where the character is just insane. I'm currently running a Pathfinder campaign. Like, an example of, like the sitcom character, I have, like, a dwarf who is the leader of, like, the militia of this town, and he's just kind of like a gruff badass who has no time for people and is constantly on the move because he's a monk, so he's faster than humans. So, like, he kind of creates humor around him because all his guards are constantly chasing after him with papers that he needs to sign, but he's never still. So he kind of drives everyone around him completely nuts, and his gruff demeanor, my players find him funny. But he also has logic with him, and when he needs to talk to them, he can be serious. Whereas I had a character who randomly decided he was going to buy 100 pounds of chocolate to try to sell it as a merchant to a neighboring settlement that doesn't have as much chocolate to try to make a profit. And I made them come across a guy who was kind of a chocolate addict. Like, he bought a bunch of it, and before he was willing to pay for it, he had to rub a little bit against his gums type of thing. And since that character, like, it was basically just a drug analog, but it's in a game, and it's chocolate, so it's not wrong. It's funny. But since that character didn't really have to be important, and hopefully they'll never meet him again because that was a creepy character to play, like, that character could just be as weird as I want. Because that character is just, no, you're here for the funny. You have, like, one bit of information you can give, and then if they like talking to you, you could be funny, because you don't have to matter.
So, just to be clear, it was a player that bought 100 pounds of chocolate?
One of my players bought 100 pounds of chocolate in an attempt to be a merchant.
As part of a larger campaign? Like, this is an epic quest?
they were already going from town one to town two, but he thought, why not make a profit out of it all at the same time?
All right. How did it work out for him?
I think he still has some of the chocolate, but I think he did manage to turn a profit. Like, it wasn't the thing that I had planned, but it's the type of thing where it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's 100 pounds of chocolate. Even if he does sell it for a profit, it's not a game-breaking amount of money because they're, like, 7th or 8th level. Like, the amount of money you make on that is fun for role-playing stuff, but it's not like, oh, I'm doing this at first level and this chocolate was all of my gold and now I get 4 times my gold. It's like I've made, like, 200 or 300 gold profit at this level that's almost negligible. That's potions. So if that makes sense, you can do that.
I don't know why, but I'm picturing a single large ball, 100-pound ball of chocolate.
Well, this character was a halfling, so that ball would have had a greater diameter than his own height. That would have been funny, but I don't think he meant it like that.
I think it would have had a larger diameter than most characters. We're talking 100 pounds of chocolate.
Yeah, but you're more than 100 pounds of Ryan.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to have to measure this later.
Now,
I don't know the comparative density of chocolate.
Now, you're often I find that when the feels get real or the scaries get scary or the uncomfortable, like when the drama is actually ramping up and the players are starting to feel it, they'll often try humor to sort of be a pressure valve. How do you know when to try to tighten off that pressure valve or to lean into it?
Well, if it's out of character, like if they're just talking amongst themselves and they want to crack a joke, unless it's going forever, normally it's like, okay, great. You're telling jokes. I find that my favorite way to stop them from doing that forever is when you think it's too far. Like, let's say they make like 5 jokes. On joke 6, tell them how that's being reacted to because you said that in character.
Yeah, I have a lot of players that like to say something mostly in character but don't expect any actual consequences for it. It's not fun as a GM. Feels a little personal.
But yeah, if you start letting after you get to a certain point of enough jokes, like, no, you take that seriously. You know, you have to deal with how you just made a really off-color joke about the princess. Like, then they have to deal with the consequences. Although, thankfully, my group is like only about half guys, so we don't have a lot of off-color jokes about princesses. It's more just dumb jokes about everything.
All right, Jordan, we're getting ready to wrap things up here. So why don't you tell us one more time about the Dice of Destiny?
Okay. Well, it is at the Just for Last Festival in Montreal. The website for that is hahaha.com. You can just look up the Dice of Destiny on that site. It is Saturday, the 21st of July at 9 p.m. At the same time, I have a couple of other things to mention, if that's okay.
Go for it.
If any of you are in Toronto, I'm not at all affiliated with this, nor have I seen it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. At the Toronto Fringe Festival, there is a show called D&D Live. It is also an improvised D&D show, or I don't know if it's actually branded D&D. I think it's probably just they have a D20, so they call it D&D. But it's been going for longer than mine has, and apparently its concept is rather different, but since I've not seen it yet, I don't know. If it turns out we're very similar, I haven't seen it yet, so no ripoffs. But from who I know is in it by reputation, I would highly recommend you see it if you're in Toronto. And also, if any of you want to try to use improv as a GM or whatever, and you're in Montreal, the Montreal Improv Theater is great for that. It's super easy to Google. You type in Montreal and improv, and it's the first result because the website is montrealimprov.com. And all the details for free workshops and whatever are there. And that's what I have to plug.
You mentioned that you were impressed with who's in D&D Live, but you didn't say who is in D&D Live.
Well, I was referring to like the regular players because I know most of them by reputation. They also have certain special guests. If any of you are fans of comedy, if it's not already sold out, I would recommend going to their, I think it's the Wednesday the 11th show because Colin Mochrie is on. And as an improviser, that's like my Beyonce, except he's also Canadian.
Wait, what? It's like your fiance? Like
Beyonce.
Oh, your Beyonce.
Like how
everything makes sense now.
How like normal people would be super into going to see Beyonce. I would much rather go see Colin Mochrie stand on stage and make stuff up for an hour than see her concert.
You had to explain it, but yes, I understand. I was just worried
point.
You were going up there and you were marrying him, or you were marrying somebody who reminds you of Colin Mochrie.
No, I think he's already married, unfortunately.
Oh, it's okay, buddy. You'll get him next time. All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much. I think this was very informative, and it's definitely a change of pace for us. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm. All right, take care. We will be right back to talk about the Pathfinder 2nd Edition news right after this.
Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news.
And we're back.
In the Pathfinder news section, we talk about what's happening for the Pathfinder role-playing game, usually from Paizo, a little bit from second-party or third-party publishers. But specifically, lately, we have been front-loading our news with basically the biggest news in the industry right now, Pathfinder 2nd Edition. We've been getting previews for the Pathfinder playtest, which, again, is not Pathfinder 2nd Edition. It is the prototype. It is what is coming before the Pathfinder 2nd Edition, but it's the first hints we have of what's going for 2nd Edition, so this is the 2nd Edition news, but we are specifically talking about Pathfinder playtests, reveals, and previews, and the blogs that have been going up on Paizo.com at a pretty regular pace. I believe it's every Monday and Friday we get a new Pathfinder playtest preview.
Indeed. When they first started, they were like, we're going to try to hit every Monday and Friday, and then they have been, and to the extent that we were at PaizoCon, and everybody was in the building, and then a blog hit. And I was like, who was there to write it?
It's also impressive that they've been going for a couple of months now, at least, if not 3 or 4. And we're still getting things like we just found out about archetypes, something that they've been hinting that they'd be talking about. Like, they've been hinting at this for a long time. We just got the Ranger preview. We've still got a lot of class previews to go through. So, like, we're getting all this content, and there's still plenty of more content to come. So as I mentioned, we finally, Param, know how archetypes are going to work. We've known for a while that it's not going to be like first edition archetypes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that it is going to hopefully fill that mechanical niche and that like major influence on the system. The idea that the classes are the classes and then the archetypes take the classes and mold them to a more specific view. But we also knew from early on that it wasn't going to be class specific archetypes. It was going to be a little bit of how prestige classes work in that you're going to have multiple ways of entering, multiple ways of accessing an archetype, but there will be prerequisites, which is not something that you usually get for archetypes. Usually, unless there's an alignment restriction, archetypes are completely free, but you need to take levels in the class. So in that way, I was very curious, like, how are they making these changes to the fundamental idea of what an archetype is, and it's still going to feel like archetypes? So, Param, having read over this article or this blog post, do you feel like this is doing the archetype concepts justice?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really worried when they were first talking about the archetypes, because that's a lot of how archetypes have been pitched for Starfinder as well. And in Starfinder, I feel that it didn't quite stick the landing they were hoping for, because it predefined what every class would give up in the event that it took an archetype, and sometimes that was too much, so or too crucial for the class to function, that it wasn't worth taking the archetype. So you don't see a lot of people in Starfinder character builds using them at all. That's also the fact there's only a couple of them in the core rulebook, and there hasn't been a lot of expansion of that game yet. But how it's working in the Pathfinder 2 playtest is that the archetype is a series of feats that you can take instead of taking what would normally be your class feat that you get at every other level in Pathfinder 2 playtest. And again, to go back for anybody that doesn't know, the class feats are basically like the rogue talents or the barbarian rage powers in other in Pathfinder First Edition, where it's modularizing which character abilities you choose and providing you with a lot of options under the label class feats. So instead of taking, say, sudden charge, you decide you're going to be a pirate. So you take the pirate dedication archetype feat. And now you've got a series of prerequisites before you can take the feat to get into it. And the pirate dedication they have listed as the example is 12 dexterity, trained in acrobatics and sailing lore. And then that feat itself opens up the selection and gives you a default ability, which is when you balance aboard a ship, you treat a success as a critical success, and you ignore difficult terrain on uneven ground. So it makes it very easy for you to do combat on ships. Oh, it also gives you acrobatics as a signature skill, which is something that we can talk about a little bit later when we go into character creation, because that's a super important thing in Pathfinder 2, getting a hold of signature skills. But the other thing is that the system locks you out of taking another archetype until you take a minimum number of archetype feats for the one you're already on. In the case, and each one will tell you how many it takes. So for the pirate archetype, you can't take another archetype until you have two other feats from the pirate. So it's a minimum 3 feat investment before you can break off of this one and go into another one if you want to stack another archetype on top of your character. Which, there's no requirement that you ever have to take those two. I mean, if this is the only feat you were going for, is, hey, I really want to be good at fighting on the rails of a ship, then you can totally go into this. But if you were wanting to branch out, you do have to fill the rest of the requirements before you can exit the archetype.
Aaron, we lost you for a second there.
No! That's terrible news. Terrible. Okay, so where did you lose me at?
Before you can ever... dot, dot, dot.
Okay, so before you can ever exit the archetype.
Yeah, and that I very much like. I like that this restriction is only restricting you from multi-archetype classing. So you can be your fighter, you can dabble in piracy, and then just spend the rest of your life as a fighter and never take those two those two archetype feats. It's not like you take a dedication feat and then your next 2 feats have to be dedicated to this archetype of yours. One thing you didn't mention, the pirate archetype has 6 feats to choose from. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be the sweet spot. That's a good number of, like, there's a variety of feats, so you can be a pirate of different variety. You can customize your pirate.
Mm-hmm.
You can take as few or as many of those. In fact, a character could take all 6 of those feats. 7 when you count the dedication feat, because that doesn't count as one of those, to be the ultimate pirate, and, you know, still while advancing in another class. And, I like that it's still flexible, and I was worried it was going to be very, like, almost like a different kind of background, because you're getting your ancestry, you're getting your background. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that those are not married to each other. In fact, this is the most customizability we've seen in second edition character building so far. Because as I mentioned last episode, my main concern about second edition is it's like, oh, it really feels like if there's a cool ability and they decide it's a fighter ability instead of a barbarian ability, barbarians that could benefit from that ability and that it makes sense for them are just screwed because it's just not their category.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like, oh no, it's broad. So you find an archetype that really does fit what you want, where you want to go with your character. And it doesn't matter what you started as. If you want to be the pirate cleric, if you want to be the pirate wizard, you can do all of that. And that I very much appreciate.
And speaking to your worry about a fighter ability, barbarian, we'll need to get back to that when we start talking about character creation, because that's something very specifically that came up when they were doing the stream on that.
That's good. And I have not seen the stream, so that is something that we will talk about after we talk about the blog articles.
Indeed.
Any hesitations about archetypes? Anything you weren't happy with in that blog part, in that particular blog post?
No, actually, I'm really satisfied with this solution to it. It almost feels like 4th edition's multiclassing, if you were familiar with that system, how it handles multiclassing. It feels a lot like that, and that was actually a really one of the things that was a strength to that system. It really? Also feels, yeah, so if you wanted to multiclass in 4th edition, you didn't take levels in another class. You just took a series of multi-class feats. There were 3 of them, I believe, in total. And each one of those let you swap one of your class features for the class you were dipping into. And it was an elegant way of blending the two character types together and not diluting your power level too much.
Speaking of power level, we did get a hint of how prestige classes are going to work. And prestige classes are now prestige archetypes. And mm-hmm. So it's exactly the same as archetypes, except there's a new keyword. So whereas the regular, the pirate archetype was archetype and dedication. Those were the two keywords for it. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Grey Maiden dedication, which is their sample prestige archetype, it's archetype, dedication, and prestige. Mm-hmm. And the way that they are mechanically different is that there's a lot more prerequisites, or the prerequisites are a lot harder to qualify for. And then, ideally, the payoff will be that you will get more powerful archetype feats related to your prestige archetype.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to list it off, to get an idea, the like I said earlier, the pirate only needed to have 12 dexterity and trained in acrobatics and sailing lore. So that's something you could qualify for right off the bat when you're character creating it. In fact, a good majority of characters that would meet the dex requirement easily, because dex is a favorite attribute to boost up no matter what character class you are. Whereas the Grey Maiden needs 16 strength, expert in fortitude save, trained in heavy armor, and all martial weapons, a member of the Grey Maidens, your Grey Maiden... The rest is the benefit. But that's a lot of things to assume, and not something you're likely going to be able to do at first level.
So there's two things I like about this. One is that it solves a lot of our issue with first edition... the archetype prestige class divide, because there were some concepts that could only be justified as a prestige class, and there were some that made better archetypes, but archetypes only came later. So a lot of those prestige classes from the core rulebook eventually became base classes or archetypes and were completely redundant. But then some concepts, like the Aldori Sword Lord, was both an archetype and a prestige class, and if you are a sword lord, it feels like it's not something you should be right from first level. Mm-hmm. So this is harder to qualify for, but anyone can qualify for it, which I like very much. Well, anyone that has heavy armor and all martial weapons. So probably not a lot of Grey Maiden wizards. But if I wanted a Grey Maiden wizard, there is a way I could do it. And for whatever reason I feel like it, I like that option is open to me.
Well, the Hell Knights still have their signifier, so at least there's some foundation for it.
Yeah, but sometimes, Param, I want to do things the hard way.
Oh, indeed. You would be doing things very hard the hard way with this. So after that one, we had a duo of tied together articles. We had the trinkets and treasure and potency and potions. We'll tackle them one at a time, but I do want to mention that this next one was a two-parter.
Yeah, and I thought the potency and potions post was, the title was misleading. Because potency really does affect all magic items.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was thinking this was more the alchemical stuff and like specifically imbibable magic items.
Mm-hmm. No. But it starts... Well, first we got the trinkets and treasure, which is really the one that was going to explain to us what the resonance system is and how they see it working in Pathfinder 2nd Edition playtest. And they call out right away that this is one of their more experimental side of things. So this is one they're probably going to want a lot of feedback on. And, oh, they've already got a lot of feedback. I think this is one of the hottest topics for the playtest at all. Ryan, are you familiar with resonance?
I am, having read this article. I know that it's based on one of the occult classes, but it's not an occult class that I have any personal experience with besides reading the book.
Oh, yeah. We had one of the characters... Actually, one of my players was playing an occultist in our Reign of Winter game until he got brutally murdered by shadows. And then he's no longer playing occultist. The basic idea of that is that the occultists were able to like tap into magic items and then power them up and unlock better and more powers using the magic items. And it was part of their ability and then part of the item's ability. And it was a neat idea for a character class. We often, when the occultist came out, we equated him to how the main character Dresden is written in the Dresden Files, and I believe that was specifically called out as the inspiration, one of the main inspirations for the class. So how it works in Pathfinder 2 playtest is that every character will have a stat called Resonance, which is calculated based equal to your level plus your charisma bonus. So now charisma now has a reason to be useful for all characters. And it represents how much you can personally power magic items. You will use it to bond to a magic item that is like an all-day item, and you will also use it and expend these resonance points to activate use-based magic items, including consumables such as potions, scrolls, wands.
So you were mentioning there were some controversy based on that system so far. What are some of the things people are hesitant about resonance?
There seems to be a lot of camps in this debate, and one of the camps is they don't want no resonance at all, that it seems to be too gamey of a system. And I have to agree that it is a very gamey system. Like, this is where I see more game than story.
I find this a perfectly logical system. It reminds me of a second edition Dragon Magazine article where it was just, if you have too many magic items together, their magic auras start messing with each other and random effects start happening. And the more magic items you pile on, the more likely and the more often you'll get these magical effects. And that is something that defined how I saw magic items. So going forward, just resonance is the perfect word for that. That is just, you are messing with powerful magic. And the more of these items that you are carrying around, the more likely you are pushing your luck. Then tying it into charisma means that, and it's based on how well you handle magic naturally. So yeah. I love all of that perfectly, and I don't see it as gamey at all. Mm-hmm. Well, not at all, but like, I think it's well integrated into how I view the magic items and how they should work.
I think a lot of the accusations of it being gamey is that they admit that this system was invented to solve a metagame problem, which is the legacy of the Happy Stick. Which, for listeners that don't know what the Happy Stick is, it's a wand of Cure Light Wounds. And in Pathfinder, especially at mid and higher levels, it's the most efficient way to make sure all your characters are healed, even above what a cleric can do naturally and by using their daily abilities, is actually just to keep a wand of Cure Light Wounds handy and keep buying them. Not any bigger wands, just the lowest magic wand available. Because between fights, you can just have anybody that can cast Cure Light Wounds, which is a surprisingly large amount of spellcasters have access to that spell. And then those that don't can often get use magic device to fake it. And just to spam that spell over and over again from a wand, because wands only cost 750 gold, which becomes trivial at mid to high levels to spend. And they have 50 charges, so you often won't use up a wand for several levels. Like, your hit point totals have to start getting pretty hefty before you start chewing through those wands at any decent clip. And by that point, you can just buy 5 and 6 of them at a time and not even miss it. And so that was specifically something they called out as the inspiration for why they were tackling this system or introducing this system, which is why I think there is a camp that is accusing it of being a very metagame system. I do agree with you that if you were to not take that point of view, it has a lot of flavor and a lot of justification, and that charisma was the perfect thing to bring into that.
They also justify that they want people using fewer magic items but more powerful magic items. Mm-hmm. So instead of using that low-level wand, you're better off getting the higher-level wand or the higher-level potions and just taking the one shot and healing as much as possible. So I do appreciate that, and I do appreciate the idea that these things are going to get more powerful. The one thing I don't like about that is the idea that at some point your magic items are not worth it. Mm-hmm. And then, like, the part of magic items, and probably the part of the game, like the broad part of the game that I like the least, is shopping, and the idea that you're just selling items and making and buying the items you want, and it's just like, nothing feels magical about this. And if you are going to be walking around with a +1 dagger, that's like, you know, this dagger has meant something, it's been by your side, but at some point it will outlive its usefulness because it's not worth its resonance anymore. I don't like the idea that you're just going to get rid of it. I wish that some of the lower level items could level up a little more efficiently, which it might. I don't think that what we know about it excludes that as an option. Mm-hmm. So I am hoping that as that is an option, and that your low level wands can become higher level wands instead of trading in the low level one to get the high level one. That feels gamey to me.
I don't know about wands, because wands are a consumable item anyway. Even under this system, the wands still had charges. But there does appear to be some hints of maybe that, because they mentioned some other magic items. Specifically, there's the Cloak of Elvenkind as one of the magic items they wanted to introduce, and it has multiple levels of that cloak. So there's a level 10 version, then there's a level 18 version. So that might be a case, if they follow Pathfinder 1's example, of something you could pay to have upgraded. In fact, in the there is like a whole bit about improving and upgrading the weapons in the next article. Also, weapons are explicitly excluded from this, unless the weapons have an activated ability. They usually just power themselves when you swing it.
I am going to... Something that, overall, after reading these last few blog posts, mm-hmm. something that's starting to bug me is a lot of the terminology is clunky.
Hmm.
Like activation. Operate activation? That doesn't feel like... Mm-hmm. That doesn't feel grammatically correct. it's like, okay, so I'm... I have to figure out what operate means, not as far as the definition, but as far as the game term as a keyword. Mm-hmm. And so that is the kind of activation that this has, versus focus activation I can kind of get behind. Some of them are passive. Likewise, with we were just talking about archetypes and the fact that the archetypes are named dedications. And so it's a pirate dedication. That doesn't sound like something my character would say. Mm-hmm. And I like minimalizing game terms that my character might have to say.
And this is a criticism I've been seeing, and a little bit I do feel about what I've seen a lot of second edition, is that there is so many keywords. Like, everything mm-hmm. is just decked out with keywords, and I don't know that it's going to matter all that much what type of activation it is or what type of feat this is, except for... with the dedications, I at least understand why they need some sort of thing there to say that this is a archetype feat, and this is the core archetype feat, the one that kicks off the others.
Why isn't it just pirate?
Yeah, I don't know. But there is like too many keywords to be following along with, just from what we've seen. And I do worry that that's going to be a continuing burden on the game going forward, especially new GMs trying to learn it and having so many different terms. Now, the item keywords are command, operate, and focus activations. And the reason that they are like that is I believe they're meant to be analogous to the verbal semantic material spellcasting actions, the components that they turned into individual actions for this system. And they define what they mean. Operate means just using the object as the object should be used. Does it? Like, you don't have to specifically say magic words or dedicate magic thoughts to it. It's just when you drink a potion, that's operating the potion. When you put on the cloak, that's operating the cloak. Or I think in this case, it's raising the hood up on the cloak is what turns its invisibility on. So that physical action is what they're calling out there. And then the focus action means something you're mentally enabling. And finally, the command means it's a command word activation. And that all seems not entirely necessary to make the differentiations there. I think just the flavor text saying, when you activate this, you pull up its cloak. I didn't need to know what type of activation it was. I just need to know it takes one action to turn this cloak on. And then I spend a resonance point. So I agree with you there, but that's sort of how they were explaining it and what they were comparing it to.
Okay, but do we really need a line that's called activation and then focus activation?
No.
Why isn't it just called activation: focus?
I agree with you totally on that one. And also resonance points are called resonance points. On your resonance? Character instead of just resonance, and resonance is a much better name. I do think they're calling out too much of the specifics on this stuff. Activation, focus, operate would be fine. Even then, I don't even think that's super necessary for these things. I think it could simply just be activate one action, do the thing.
So there is one thing I will credit them for, something I didn't think about, but in the how to play test seminar, I just listened to that this week, and Jason Millman specifically calls out that they don't want iconography and they don't want color coding as shortcuts for terminology, because they want e-readers, text readers,
right,
to be able to read it to people that are visually impaired, and they want colorblind people to be able to read and play the game as easily as, you know, full spectrum eyed peoples. So that is a noble reason to not switch to iconography, which is the direction that board games have been going. Like, board games want to minimize language so that no matter what language you speak, you can pick up a game and figure out the icons.
Right.
They're going in the opposite direction, and I respect that, but that means they really have to make sure that these keywords are self-explanatory and not clunky.
Yeah,
and that's the phase we're at now. Unclunkying the clunky words or terms.
And I think it's worth, absolutely, and it is laudable that they're taking that into account, because not a whole lot of companies are considering things such as assistive needs at all. And I'm glad that we're seeing a lot of that movement in it from Paizo and in the game space. I know in the video game space, Microsoft just made a big splash because they put a huge amount of R&D into a accessible controller type. So I'm glad to see the industry finally paying attention to this, because this has been a topic that I've been dedicated to in my other professional life for a decade, and it is often infuriating that people don't even think about it or take it into account or think of it as a burden. And Paizo certainly did not need to. There is not a reason that they had to take this on, and I'm glad to see that they are taking it on. But it still has to be, like you said, it still has to feel natural. It still has to feel good to read this stuff and to play it. You don't want to overgild the lily on this.
Overgild the lily?
Yeah, I screwed that up, so I'm trying to move past it now, Ryan.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought it was an expression I didn't know, and I was like, what? Tell me more.
I'm trying for an expression that's something about the lily, but whatevs. I'm moving on. The other thing that seems to have been getting a lot of attention is that the consumable items are also using this resonance. See, a lot of people seem to be totally on board with the resonance and bonding with magic items, or tapping into your resonance to use your magic items. But then there's a split on how consumables should be treated. Should it cost you a resonant point to drink a potion or use a wand? And explicitly, this was meant to stop the happy stick. So the wand definitely has to be affected by resonance, or they're not even accomplishing their primary goal with this. But they have decided to make... with the potions, it's pretty much a non-issue. There's people that disagree whether or not it should matter or if you should spend the resonance, but at least people seem to understand. I drink a potion, the potion's gone. I drank it. There's no recycling the potion. But where the wands and the staves still have charges built into their game system, and they do call out in the blog that they were trying to get rid of excess bookkeeping with the magic items by making everything tie into resonance. And so now, but the wands still have charges, so you're still doing that bookkeeping. And I think a lot of people were expecting this system with, oh, well, if I'm spending my resonance, that means that the wands don't have charges. I have the wand, I can use the spell as long as I have resonance to spend on it. And in this case, they still have the charges. Now, there has been a lot of talk back and forth with some of the Paizo. I know Mark Moreland is very busy in the comments on that. And there's been a lot of back and forth on what an alternative could be for that. But that seems to be the other big divide.
Yeah, that one I can get on board the criticism that wands should no longer have charges. I know a lot of character sheets and equipment trackers have cleverly designed spaces so that you can keep track of charges. It takes up a fair amount of space because it's like you need 50 tiny circles. And I don't have an issue with counting charges in first edition, but it does feel like something that it would be for the benefit of the game and for the players if they can find an alternative.
Right. I liked one of the suggestions that's kind of been going through it is how stabs work. And this is actually worth calling out. So how stabs are going to work in second edition playtest is they do have staff charges that that build up over time. Like you're able to recharge the staffs like you can in first edition by just actually, and this happens just automatically based on what your highest level spell that you can cast is. That's how many charges get added to the staff every single day. And then they have a list of spells and how many charges it costs to cast those spells using the charges on the staff. Or you can use your resonance. Well, you have to use your resonance either way. But they also letting the staves kind of function as like a repository for spells known. So if the spell is on the staff, you can spend the resonance and then swap one of your spells that you have prepared to instead cast the spell on the staff. So in a sense, the staves just basically become a magic itemized version of the favored spell feat or spontaneous casting conversion feats or abilities like the druid and cleric have. Which is neat. That's a neat way to handle those staves and have them matter. And they're also providing a static bonus when you cast the spells that they're associated with. Like their DCs go up or you heal more hit points or things like that. So a suggestion has been going through. They say that if they took the charges off the wands, that those wands would then become much more expensive objects. Such as like they point to the Elven Clan cloak that cost a whole lot more than a 75 gold wand of invisibility would cost. It's 1,000 gold for the cloak that lets you use a resonance to turn invisible. And the wand of invisibility, they say, is a 75 gold or 74 gold. I forget the exact on that. But the big suggestion going through the community right now that seems to have a lot of people on board and I'm kind of in favor of is to just turn the wands into single spell staves. So this is a wand of burning hands and I can spend a resonance point to sack one of my prepared spell and cast burning hands through this wand. And as long as I'm holding this wand and I've invested into it like you do with the other objects, whenever I cast Burning Hands, whether it's from the wand or I prepared Burning Hands for the day and I'm casting it through this wand, it gets a bonus because this wand is really good at Burning Hands. And so you would have a situation where spellcasters would intentionally go and get wands for their favorite spells, even if they intended to prep multiple of them to begin with.
Now, Param, I'm going to make a suggestion that is going to affect you more than it would affect me.
Uh-huh.
And it may be blasphemous, so you just let me know if I've crossed the line.
Roger.
But does second edition need wands?
Mechanically, no. Mechanically, no, it doesn't need wands. The fantasy of the game has a legacy of wands being an object, and all of fantasy mm-hmm. has the concept of there being an object called a magic wand is important. And second edition wouldn't be the first edition, second edition Pathfinder even wouldn't be the first game in its legacy to ditch that concept of what wands do. Fourth editions just turned wands into one of the options of focus that wizards could take, and the ability that just choosing wands as your focus just let you cast touch spells way more accurately. Your two hit rolls were a lot easier when you were using wands because it was super easy to point at them. And so it gave up the concept that we've classically assigned to wands over the previous editions of the game. I think that second edition needs a magic wand of some variety to exist. It doesn't necessarily need it to be the same concept that we've associated with them, though. It doesn't need to be this is a wand of Cure Light Wounds, therefore it casts Cure Light Wounds. It could just be, this is the wand of the spider, and it's really good bonus to spellcasters who like to cast darky spells or spidery things. Or just it could just be a generic Wondrous Atoms of various, or they could take over the space that the metamagic rods were taking up. You could do anything with them, but there needs to be something in the game that is a magic wand, because that's just a core staple of all fantasy fiction.
I do agree with that. So one of the arguments that I'm thinking beyond just if we've got potions and we've got staves the way they work now, why do we need wands? Is that think about art. How often do you see a wand depicted in Pathfinder art?
Almost never.
Right. You see staves, and you see staves with magical crackling going on. You see wizards with their spell books open doing grand gestures, even though that's not something you can mechanically do.
No.
But wands is something that every character that has a spellcasting ability, they have at least one wand in their repertoire, but it's never pictured in the art. Because when we're picturing our characters, we're not picturing them waving a wand like a Harry Potter character. It's just, it's not entirely tied into the fiction, right, or the fantasy.
It's because wands in D&D and then in the Pathfinder First Edition were a commodity. They weren't an implement or a tool. They were just literally, this is a selection of expendable nonsense and magic that I have, and I have no emotional attachment to it because it will run out eventually, and it is just a convenience. There's no, like, a fighter really cares about his magic sword, and that's why stabs are so important for characters. Because those are permanent things that stay with you and have a purpose. And wands, they just are used up. It's no different than my mechanical lead in my pencil or the rations on my character sheet. It's just these rations happen to turn me invisible.
But even potions are depicted in art more often than wands. Potions will be hanging off of a belt more often than... I guess I have seen wands holstered on a wizard. I think the metamagic rod idea, or rods in general, might be the direction to go with wands, and make de-emphasize how important they are to characters, since they don't seem to be important to how we visualize and show our characters in action.
That's almost a purely I think that's because of what the wands have been historically, and the fact that it's limited to a specific subset of characters that themselves don't want to be defined by it because of how ephemeral they are. They're super expensive to begin with, so you don't start with them. And when you level up and finally get them, you don't care about them because they're just another throwaway temporary thing. Whereas if we look at other fantasy art and other fantasy novels and stuff, ones there do exist, and they are used, and they are part of the fantasy of the magical archetype. But you're specifically in Pathfinder art, you don't see it a lot because they aren't important to the characters that use them.
Now, I know, Param, you said that we were going to do the two blog articles about magic items one at a time. It really feels like we've blended them together, because the second one was about potency and resonance. Resonance? I don't know why I'm always adding a D that's not there. I'm not fully saying residence, but I'm not saying resonance properly.
Right.
I feel like we've covered both of them pretty well. Is there anything from the second blog article that you'd like to touch on that we haven't talked about yet?
The rune system for the magic weapons is interesting to look at, because, well, it seems runes are kind of like coming in to the additional weapon properties. They call out Vorpal and Disrupting as enchantments that could appear on runes. But the interesting there is they're introducing rune stones, which are just basically a magic property that you can slot into a magic weapon, and then take it out and slot it into your next magic weapon. So it's like getting a flaming rune means that you can just slap it on this sword, and this is now a flaming magic sword. And if I get a magic spear I like better, I can take it out, and now it's a flaming magic spear. That's interesting, that because that's not a concept that's existed in this game, but it's something we've seen in more modern, or not even more modern, it's a concept that's been around for like 20 plus years in other forms of gaming, having these temporarily slotted magic abilities that you can add to your equipment. And it's something we saw in Starfinder in the concept of fusion seals that do the same thing. Okay, so this is something we've seen implemented a whole lot before in not so much fiction, but in games, because it's a fun system to play with, to customize a magic weapon with different abilities readily. So I'm kind of interested to see how that will affect play in Pathfinder, because I think it's a great idea for a system. So if it's done well, this should add a lot of options and customization and fun at the game table.
I also appreciate they go into it a little bit, that items, special item properties, so special materials, rather. So like cold iron will be able to handle fewer runes and will be able to interact with magic items differently. That that will be another factor in customizing your weapons. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I know that we've been talking about streamlining and making things simple, but the special magical property is another part of fiction, and it should be kept separate from the magical aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that only left one more blog post to talk about, and that was the Ranger class preview. And oh gosh, there was a lot to learn about the Ranger in this class preview. Mostly that the Ranger is now the Slayer.
Effectively, right down to not being able to cast spells. Indeed. That was something we learned right in the introduction, that the default Ranger will not be casting spells. I don't know if, because there's a separation now of spells and rituals we've learned in the magic section. Mm-hmm. Ranger is a class that I see doing a lot of rituals when I'm picturing famous Rangers, but it's true. You don't picture Rangers casting spells in the middle of combat. But as far as the Slayer similarities, yeah, favorite enemy is now basically favorite target. It's called hunt target. And it's actually a little more diverse than just the favorite target, which really was just, I do damage to you. And I get some bonuses for skills. This is a nice variety of things. It interacts differently depending on melee versus ranged weapons. And it can still interact with two-weapon fighting. This is really the first time we've seen a focus on two-weapon fighting as a core part of the class. We know that it was two-weapon fighting has been taken away from the fighter to the point that the Valoros doesn't even use his iconic dagger in the art now. Valoros has now become a shield wielder. But Harsk, in this new iconic art, where his facial structure is different than we were used to for him, and doesn't entirely line up with the new art for the dwarves. It, not that it's like contradicts it, it's just like this is a Harsk face, not the new dwarf face. Here he's seen wielding two weapons, and that's not what we're used to from Harsk. We're used to him wielding that crossbow, which he still has on his back. But it just shows that this is the emphasis of the Ranger now. You really can be the range guy or the two-weapon fighting guy, but you can still be the two-weapon fighter. That has not been taken away from the Ranger, even though a lot of other things that they're known for has been.
I really appreciate the direction they're taking, because as soon as, when Pathfinder was first even being introduced, there were calls throughout the community to reinvent the Ranger to not use spellcasting. I do know that there are some people that do like that aspect of the Ranger, because it's been a part of the game since there's been a Ranger in the game. But it doesn't fit a lot of the class fantasy. A lot of people just want to be the really cool scouty nature-y fighter that we see in, you know, Aragorn and a lot of elven examples of their characters. And it is just what the fans seem to have wanted. And so even though they're going in this direction, I'm not seeing a whole lot of backlash through the community. There is definitely some, but there's been some for every single change. Doesn't matter which change, there's somebody that doesn't like it, but there's a lot less here. And there was a whole lot of calls, to the point that a spellless ranger was one of the best articles in Kobold Quarterly. We called it out on the podcast when that article was published. And then when Pathfinder produced their own spellless ranger, it was one of the more popular archetypes for the ranger. It seems that people intentionally wanted to get rid of that class feature. They just did not want it for their character fantasy. And I think changing the hunt target or ability and
favorite enemy.
Changing to a hunt target is the way to go, because favorite enemy involved a whole lot of metagame choice, and then it had a very steep penalty for getting that choice wrong. For instance, in my Rise of the Rune Lords game, One of my players chose goblins as their favorite enemy because they knew it would be an enemy they fought. And then you get out of that first book and there sure aren't a whole lot of goblins anymore. It also was an ability that your first choice you kept getting better at, when realistically the things you wanted to hunt at low level you no longer cared about at high level, because you were fighting at bigger, stronger creatures that you would want the stronger bonuses for. So oftentimes you would see rangers of first level say, evil outsiders is mine. And like, you're not going to fight a lot of evil outsiders for a few levels. So that's an ability that just does not get used at all, so that it becomes useful at higher levels when they are facing a foe like that.
It also calls out in the blog post that most rangers will be favorite enemy humans.
Indeed. That
you go to ranger school and the first thing they teach you is how to kill humans. This is an important skill. It makes sense logically, but the idea that every nature-based creature is an assassin of humanity is kind of a scary thought.
Mm-hmm.
Another change. This is a sentence I'm going to read verbatim.
Uh-huh.
Specific ranger feats allow him to gain an animal companion at the same progression as a druid's.
Thank goodness.
Potentially with special benefits that only a ranger can obtain. So you said that the ranger is now the slayer. The ranger is also the hunter.
Indeed. Well, can be the hunter.
Yes. Okay, it's true, because those are feats. So you're not defaulted to have an animal companion. If you want to go that route, you could be as good as a druid.
Yeah. And also the druid has to go specifically for the animal companion too. That's not an assumption anymore. Which we saw during the banquet previews. And again, if you've seen the banquet preview Twitch chat or the live broadcast that Paizo put out, it's worth going to see our version of that, because we have much better views of the slides. So you're able to actually read a lot of the text on those things that they put up on screen that we as an audience got to read at the time, but didn't show up very well during the live broadcast.
Can I make an anecdote about that video?
Sure.
So during that part, Jason Bowman was saying like, oh no, I hope people don't see this and screen capture it. And, you know, like what we did, like we coordinated with Paizo. Paizo mm-hmm. shared the file, the slide. So like,
yeah. mm-hmm.
When he was making that joke, I was like, just in case he's serious, I'm only going to put this up for 5 seconds, whereas every other slide I put up for 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And after publishing it, I realized it's like, no, you pause.
Yeah.
People can pause and read everything on there. They're not writing everything down in 5 seconds, going back in the video and trying to write some more. So, yeah, I felt kind of foolish.
No, but that's something we did with the knowledge and cooperation in Paizo.
Yes. Okay, so we talked about they can have animal companions. One thing that surprised me is that it references the Hunter's Bond class feature. Probably one of the least used options of any class feature from the core rulebook that has an A and a B an option is the hunter. The ranger can bolster their allies option, because it's a standard action, and so instead of being a fighter, you're a bad bard. But the legacy of that option, the idea that the ranger is there to give pointers to the group and help people out, is still there. This is still an angle of the ranger that is being supported, and I know it's probably not something that people are like, well, my ranger always takes that ability, but it is probably something that people look at that ability and say, I would take that if it wasn't so terrible. And so now they have an option to revisit the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This also, it seems that the ranger is going to be one of the most mechanically changed classes in Pathfinder 2nd. There's very little of the original ranger mentioned in here, because their core ability has changed. How the combat is going to work with weapon specializations has changed system wide. The animal companion's not even automatic. And of course, magic's gone. And the abilities they mentioned are stuff that other classes had, not even the ranger.
And finally, snares. Snares were, there is the Trapper Ranger archetype, the one from Ultimate Magic that is not a magical archetype. Yeah, this has now become a core option for Rangers, that you can be setting up snares, you can be setting up traps, and there seems like there's a wide variety of them. So I have a feeling this is going to be an option that's going to be encouraged just because of the level of design that has to go into it. I'm sure that the the design team would not want to hear that they put all these, you know, page count into this one ability, this one track that you can take with your ranger and nobody uses it. I like that traps are a core part of it, because a lot of new players will often ask me, okay, I want to set up a trap. How do I do that? And I'm like, unfortunately, you have to take a specific class and a specific archetype. Otherwise, there's no real clean rules for players doing it. It's not far off in that you still need to take a specific class and specific options. But at least now I don't have to point to a book that it shouldn't belong in and say, and you have to specifically buy this book.
Well, secondly, on to counteract that a little bit, they do mention in the comments that they didn't mean to imply to marry the snares to the ranger as much as it appears here. While rangers are good at snares and get options to be good at snares, they're not the only ones that can be. Evidently, the snares will be an option available to many characters that want to use them, but the ranger does have some abilities that tie in well with them.
Now, my one fear about this is, as a GM, knowing where these snares are and having to ignore that to run my monsters over them. This has always been... This is the type of option that, as a GM, makes me uncomfortable, because I am more in my head than I usually like to be.
Indeed. But... I mean, it's something you have to do as a GM, and to be honest, this is stuff we do as a GM all the time. We ignore things that we know because we know all things.
It's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, between my having to do that as a GM and having the options, I definitely say no. Get this option in the game. This is something that players want to be doing. This just makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to do it, there's some ways to work around that. You can have the player, you can do it battleship style and just put it on your map and just have the player write on a hidden piece of paper where the snare is, and then he can go, "Aha! You stepped on my snare!" If you wanted to, I'm just going to have the stupid orcs run into it because that's the more fun option at the table.
Fun?
Yeah. Fun trumps everything.
Now, that's it for the blog post. Mm-hmm. You have a link here in our notes to the character video on Twitch.
Yes.
Yeah, so I have not watched this video.
On Friday, Jason Bowman got on Twitch with Dan, and they walked through how to create a character in the playtest. So this is finally going to answer a lot of things about how characters were made. And specifically, they went into how the background and your ancestry and your class choices affected like what stats and skills and such and feats you have. So they talked about this at the banquet as well, that it's ABC. First you pick your ancestry, and so during the stream Jason chose elf, and then you choose your background and he chose exiled. And then you choose your class, and he went barbarian. So he was creating an elf barbarian.
Totally on board.
Yep. Okay. So when he chose elf, that besides the various ancestry feats that you could take, and I'm not going to go into everything, but I do want to go into how the stats were chosen and mention when there were abilities. So with ancestry, it looks like you get a feat when you choose your ancestry. So you will get an ancestry feat right away. And then you will get more ancestry feats when you level up periodically. So it doesn't look like it's something you choose to get into ancestry feats. It looks like, if I'm looking at the character sheet right, which they show the character sheet, it's a landscape character sheet, and on the back they have all the different feats listed with the levels you will get that feat option in. And so ancestry, they had like 1, 5, 7, I don't know what they were, but they were just listed there. And when you hit this level, you are going to fill this blank in with your choice of what feat goes here. That's a neat thing. So you will get ancestry feats, and elves in this case got a bonus to dexterity and intelligence, and a penalty to charisma, which they called a flaw.
Not constitution?
Sorry, constitution, you're right. Whew. Okay, and that maps with what we know about the elf, where they get +2 to dex and int, and they get -2 to constitution. So this doesn't... This just seems to be a direct analogy to what we're used to. Also, at that point in time, they got what was called a free bonus, which is a bonus that at that point in character creation, they got to put a plus. And they were basically just doing exactly that, putting a plus next to the stat. They got to pick where their next bonus would go, and he chose strength because barbarian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then periodically through character creation, they went to class, and class gave you a set bonus. And then you got another free choice bonus. The set bonus was to the key stat of the class, and for barbarians that was strength. So I was a barbarian, I put a plus next to strength, and I get another bonus that I can put anywhere that didn't get a bonus at this step. And I think that went into con to counteract the penalty. I think the background also had a bonus and a set. Yeah, the background had a set bonus that you got to choose between two, which was for the exiled, you had to choose between constitution and intelligence. I may have got that wrong, but he chose constitution so that he could get two bonuses in constitution. And that was set, but then it also gave him a free bonus that he put into strength. And then when all that was said and done, you then get four free bonuses. And the only restriction there is you can't double up on that step. So he picked four more stats to get a bonus. And at the end of it, he had an elf that had 18 strength, 12 constitution, 14 dex, 12 int, 12 wisdom, and 12 charisma. So a pretty typical spread of stats, and I was kind of impressed that an elf barbarian managed to get to 18 in its primary stat, even using this new system. And it kind of gave us a little bit of an example of how this new system was going to generate attribute points. And there was a lot more free choice than I expected when we heard that the choices you made would guide where those bonuses went. It seems that the vast majority of the bonuses you get to choose where they go, or you get a choice between two options, and then there are literally only three that are set in stone. One was your ancestry, which is just like Pathfinder First Edition, and then one was your background. Oh, no, and your class always got a raise in its primary stat.
So now this... An earlier argument I had was that if you're not going to be rolling dice the way that you've traditionally been generating ability scores, then there's no reason for the ability scores to still be on a 20 scale. It feels like half those bonuses, like have those bonuses and make it a 10 scale. Like it just feels more logical.
Well, honestly, especially when you saw how these immediately turned into stats, all the pluses basically turned into the bonus that the ability scores generate. So having four pluses in strength meant that you had an 18 strength, which just so happens to be plus four, because the bonuses are always plus two. And then when I'm looking at the rest of the system, everything is based off the bonuses, to the point that even equipment load is based off the bonuses, not the stats.
Really?
Yeah. Because how bulk is calculated, it's like five plus your strength bonus is what is encumbered. So as long as you're under that, you're not encumbered. And your max load is 10 plus your stat bonus for strength. So that's super easy to calculate compared to the old system where you had to look up that chart that was always never where you expected it to be. And you always had to look it up in the index to find it. And it was annoying. So, the 20 stats don't need to exist at all in this system. They could go full mutants and masterminds, and all you're doing is the bonuses. I think the only reason the stats still go to 20 is so that the rolling the dice is still something you can choose to do, because they did say that that option for generating ability scores would still be in the playtest as an option. Though for the actual playtest part, they want, if you're participating in the playtest, they do want you to try the default option for that, which they mentioned in the How to Playtest seminar.
But if rolling the dice is still an option, it's still, your character sheet still only needs the bonus. So the rolling the dice option in the rulebook can just have a chart that, hey, if you got an 18, then it's a +4 on your character sheet. There really is no reason for an ability score anymore.
Yeah. I mean, there was barely a reason for the ability score to exist in first edition Pathfinder. And in Starfinder, they're criticizing it for the same reason, that that system got so tightened down that there is exactly one reason at all, that calculating your carry load is the only reason the ability score matters, and qualifying for 2 feats is the only reason your ability score matters in Starfinder. So I don't know why, other than to try to protect the sacred cows or to make this not feel too different, that they can't just go to pure bonuses as your stats.
Yeah. The second edition is already the sacred cow slayer.
Yeah, there's so much being changed in this. I think they may just think that that's a bridge too far. But I don't see why. I mean, mutants. I've played a lot of Mutants and Masterminds. It works great in that system. All I worry about is strength +4, and that's how much I add to strength rolls. And it's super easy to keep in your head.
I don't know if you've ever had this. Sometimes when I've got a new player and I tell them, okay, you've got like, okay, your strength is 18, so that's a +4. And they're like, oh, okay, so it's 22 strength? It's like, no, it's not. You're not adding 4 to your 18. It's, this is now, anything that matters related to strength is a +4.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, this system is a system that has completely eliminated the need for the ability score.
Like, the other reason it kind of made sense was that main chart at the beginning of character creation, where like bonus spells and stuff were based off different ability scores for different classes, and your carry load, and like just a bunch of legacy stuff left over from second edition. And none of that matters at this point in the game. It didn't even matter in the last version of the game. Pathfinder 1, your ability scores did not matter except for qualifying for feats, and they could have just changed that over to the applicable bonus. And did you ever, ever, ever intentionally have an odd ability score in Pathfinder 1? If you did, it was on the way to getting an even one, right?
I mean, yeah, not intentionally. You're right. Like, if I'm doing points buy and it's like, all right, well, I've got a remainder, I might as well make this a 13 instead of a 12. Mm-hmm. But yeah, unless it's like, if I make this a 15 now, then when I get my +1 to an ability score, I can make it a 16, and that matters. Like, the only planning is for eventually this will be an even number.
Right.
And just while we're on the subject, mm-hmm. I have always been super frustrated that the bestiaries list the ability score and not the ability score bonus, because ability score bonus is the information I need. Mm-hmm. Why did they ever choose to put the thing that, like, putting them both makes sense, mm-hmm. but just putting the ability score is completely useless to me. It requires complete memorization of the system, which eventually I got, but still, it's the wrong choice.
Well, good news, Costello. What we saw at the banquet for the bestiary articles they show the ability score bonuses on the critters, not the scores.
Thank you. Now, can they also list which save it's affecting? Because that was the other thing that always drove me nuts. That it's like, here's the DC of the save. Figure out which save it is. And then you could be surprised just how often you could be confused whether it's Fort or Will.
I think a lot of that is going to be spelled out. If from what we've seen there, with the simplification of the monster rules and the fact that it's just literally, this is the information you need while running the monster, I'm hoping that won't be an issue going forward at all.
Well, also the codification of the rules and the way things are being extremely spelled out. Mm-hmm. It feels like not spelling things out is not a worry that we should have right now.
Exactly.
You reminded me when you mentioned key abilities that we don't know the Ranger's key ability score.
Most
of the previews, it's mentioned it.
Yeah, no, they don't mention it. I'm assuming it's Dex.
I would also assume Dex, or maybe they would do Dex/Wisdom. So like the monk where you would get to choose one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll find out.
Just because wisdom is always associated with wilderness type characters.
Yeah. All right, and that's that's the second edition playtest news we have to give at this point. So, how has this affected your excitement for second edition, or odds of converting?
Archetypes have me very excited. That mm-hmm. is probably the one blog post that is most like. It most directly addresses my hesitation. Mm-hmm. And so that I appreciate. The magic items, it seemed like you were saying that there's a lot of people in a lot of different camps. Mm-hmm. I seem to be in the camp that agrees with most of those changes. And okay. So that's something that if there's – that might be scaring some people off, but that hasn't scared me away. And the character creation, the one thing that I'm worried about is that the ability score generation will not generate enough variety of characters. And I'm coming from a character that still, given the choice, will roll up my ability scores, specifically because I am intrigued by the abilities, by the variety of ability scores I might get. And anytime I roll up a points by character, it just feels like there's one or two different sets of numbers I will always roll up or always buy up. And so that's the one thing that it's like, I am going to miss more variety to ability scores. Mm. Like the fact that it's going to be nearly impossible to have a penalty to your ability score is unfortunate, because a lot of the times when I'm making a character and it's like, I am stuck with an ability score penalty, that becomes like a defining part of that character's life and a character personality.
Well, it sounds like all non-humans are going to have at least one penalty. It's on you if you want to buy it off or not.
I foresee everyone buying it off.
I guess that's fair enough.
Like, even as someone that when I roll up characters randomly, I appreciate having a penalty. When I'm doing points by, I very rarely to basically never have a penalty. No. So given the option, I don't want it, even though I appreciate it when it's there. I know it's a contradiction, but it's just the reality of why would I deliberately give myself that kind of penalty?
Oh, gosh. Glanville has 7 strength right now in No Direction of Interest.
You doing okay?
He's getting by. He's getting by. When he took that strength damage, I'm worried.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Since you brought up Adventurous, this is actually a pretty good lead into the next news item. It's not a second edition news item, but might as well do that. And then I've got an Adventurous anecdote.
Okay.
Crystal Frazier, the game master for Adventurous.
Oh, yes. Now
former employee at Paizo. Today was her first... not day of working there, not counting holidays. Mm-hmm. So Crystal's been working at Paizo for 9 years on and off. She at one point was working on more like administrative stuff. Like she was managing the blog or whatever. And she was freelancing. So like she was doing creative stuff, but in a freelance capacity. And her official job was a little more administrative. And then she got let go and then brought back as a full-time creative. And since then, and then she started doing the comic as a freelancer, because she is just someone that is bubbling over with creative energy and ideas, and she just needs as many outlets as possible. And so that has led to her looking for opportunities as a full-time freelancer. So she has left Paizo, and she will continue to work for them. She is leaving on good terms, and we wish her all the best in her future opportunities. I know that she already has several plans, which I won't divulge because, it's none of your business, listeners.
It's her business to divulge when she's ready.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But, this is a good thing. This is ultimately, it is Crystal's decision. Mm-hmm. Paizo has accepted it. We will continue to get Crystal Frazier options for Pathfinder and Starfinder, has she written anything for Starfinder?
I don't know offhand, but I would assume yes. I know that a lot of the adventure writers were trading work across things.
That makes sense.
No, if she wrote anything for Starfinder offhand, though, it would.
Well, it is one of the specific things she was saying, that I now will continue to freelance for Pathfinder and Starfinder. Like, she called out that she would be working on Starfinder. So her leaving Paizo has actually broadened her ability to contribute to Paizo. Plus, being a talented artist, cartographer. I don't know if she can sing. I'll have to ask that. But every other creative endeavor that I've ever heard you can have, Crystal is great at it. So people can look forward to many more Crystal Frazier contributions and just a wider variety of them now. And people have asked if she will continue to GM for Adventurous. Absolutely. Her capacity, or like her position as a Paizo employee, had nothing to do with her Adventurous, or like her position in Adventurous. It was cool that we got the developer of that adventure path to run it. And it's cool that we had a Paizo employee running it, but it's coolest that we had Crystal Frazier, the person, running that adventure path.
Yeah, and Crystal's responsible for so many great adventures that she has written, including one of the most famous Pathfinder adventures, The Harrowing, was one of her work. She did work on Iron Gods and Giant Slayer, and she was also responsible for the background and personality for Shadra, the shaman iconic.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing, like, she would champion a lot of causes, and so a lot of the time when we would credit Paizo, just broadly saying, like, here are things that Paizo is doing in name of inclusion and made of integrating different social issues into their stories, Crystal was often the most directly responsible for those things being included. And as you see in the blog post, she's also raised awareness among the staff, and a lot of people really respect her ability to stay on top of social issues, communicate them to other people, and educate them. Like, a lot of times on the internet, you'll see people argue that there's no point in arguing because no one will ever change their position. Crystal Frazier is the kind of person that can get people to change their position.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see her on a lot of panels on the subjects of various diversity issues and inclusion issues in gaming. I mean, gosh, she's on so many panels, not even outside of that. She spoke on so many panels at Paizo Cons and Gen Cons. It was like she was almost an honorary host of the show just because of how many hours of her talking we have on this network.
I also enjoy when she's on a panel, she'll usually start the panel by saying, like, okay, so we're here for, and then say something nonsensical and not the actual topic. I like that she chose a variety of nonsensical things. She doesn't just make the same joke every time. Mm-hmm. She uses the same joke template to make a variety of jokes.
Indeed. Well done, Crystal.
So before we move on to the next news item, there's something I want to call out. I guess it's a shout out to Roll20 and features that I wasn't really aware of. Mm-hmm. So people know that we are running War for the Crown and running Adventurous using Roll20. And this is, we are being provided the materials for, to run it by Roll20 in a, you know, it's a sponsorship arrangement. I was telling Tina about what, you know, my wife Tina, I was telling her about some of the stuff that happened in the last session. And I was describing this one NPC that it's like, you know, Crystal described him one way and then she showed us the art and we all kind of found him adorable, which clearly was not the intent of the character when she was describing him. And so I was telling Tina this and I was like, you know what? I could log into Roll20. I can show you the art. That stuff is all archived in our game.
Mm-hmm.
So like I have an archive. I have everything we've ever spoken in chat, all of our handouts. I could go and reference at any time. And that is not something I realized was an advantage of Roll20. And I am extremely excited to have access to that now.
I found out that when I was logging in to prep my Skittermander game, and then I saw every other game I've ever run for Society there, and I was able to just like take things I already worked on and just use them.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And another feature, so when I run the game, or when we're playing an Adventurous, I have had tabs open for D20 PFSRD and the Pathfinder PRD and Archives of Nethys, just because I reference different material different ways, and having access to all of those sites is useful. Completely forgetting that the entire Pathfinder rule set is tabbed and searchable within Roll20. And that there's absolutely no reason I need to be going to these other websites other than weird habits and weird associations of this information you are ideally get at this website. So starting the next recording, I am definitely going to try and play completely without those tabs, use just the Roll20 rules feature because what am I doing, Param?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so this is going to sound like I'm speaking for the sponsor on this one, but I couldn't help notice that on the prepared stuff that they've done, because we're using the War for the Crown module developed by Roll20 module that they've put together that you can pay to use. It has all the Fog of War stuff like exactly mapped to the room like perfectly, and just that alone, just the work there, I was like, I'm sitting there and just admiring it because I can just like barely see the line when we're playing before Crystal opens it up, and I can just see the different room lines. I'm like, and all the grid is matched up in advance, which is really annoying because Paizo maps don't always have grids that are real. So even when you have the map art and you put it on that layer and you measure out this grid to get it lined up, and then you'll notice it's fine here, and across the map all my intersections are in the middle because Paizo cheats at their grids. all of that has been taken care of in Roll20, and just that amount of stuff that it saved is just like, oh my gosh, I totally wish I was playing a prepared module that somebody else did all this work for me.
Yeah, I know that when I've played on Roll20, and because when we were doing Hell's Rebels, we were doing it partially people around the table, and then some people were playing remote, and so our game table was Roll20. And when Jeff took the time to do the Fog of War, I appreciated it. And when he didn't, I pointed it out. It's like, ah, oh, I like when we do maps with Fog of War. And he's like, do you know how much work that is? So having that work done, like as someone who doesn't want to do any prep as a GM, that's extremely valuable.
Right. What I usually do with the Fog of War when I'm having to do it manually is I just Fog of War the whole map and then just get the eraser and just erase the room.
I know you said that it just sounds like we're complimenting the sponsor, and we are, but this is all sincere compliments. And honestly, sometimes I feel like we don't bring enough attention to the fact that we've got all these cool Roll20 features while we're playing the game. But I'm definitely super happy that we are running this on Roll20. Like, we are playing with some of the greatest players that I know, and the greatest players I know just happen to be spread all over the continent. And I am really happy that I get to do this, and Roll20 has super facilitated that and has offered me a whole bunch of features that make my game better. So shout out to Roll20. More than just a sponsor, also a great service.
Alrighty. Are we ready to wrap this up?
We should talk about the Ennies.
Oh, that was good to pitch. Alright, so the Ennies nominees were announced. And there was a lot of love for Starfinder and no love for Pathfinder in the Ennies this year. Starfinder was nominated for 8 categories, including Product of the Year with the Core Rulebook, Best Supplement, Starfinder Pact Worlds, Best Setting, Starfinder Pact Worlds, Best Monster / Adversary, Starfinder Alien Archive, and that one better win it, because it really is the best monster book I have read in 10 years. Honestly, that book is so well done that I want that to be the future template of all the Pathfinder monster books from now on. They knock that one out of the park. Best free product was First Contact, which is like the bonus bestiary that Pathfinder got when it first came out. Best cartography is Pact Worlds. Best interior art, nominated Starfinder Core Rulebook. Best aid and accessory, the GM screen. I think that's probably just a popular award. It's got really cool art, but it's just a GM screen. But like, I don't understand when GM screens get this award unless they do something super unique, because GM screens are GM screens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. GM screens have, they are just not as useful as you used to think they are. I have no problem running without a GM screen at this point, actually.
Oh, I love my GM screens, and I especially
don't
like
customizing. Don't you have the cool castle, though?
Yeah. But I have the... So what I did with the castle is I don't always use the castle because it's not appropriate for Starfinder, because it's a castle.
Yep.
I wouldn't want a spaceport or a cool starship or something. But even when I'm using the castle, I printed out... Actually, I went into Photoshop and rearranged all the tables that I actually do use. Not all of them, but the ones that I like. And then I printed those out on cards, and I just like lean them against the inside of the castle on the shelves so that I still have the stats to quick reference when I need them.
That's good. I'm surprised that they don't do Adventure Path specific GM screens, because they've already got the art and they've got rules that are specific to the adventure paths enough that you could fill the back of any GM screen.
And that's something 5th edition does.
Oh, yeah?
They have adventure-specific GM screens. And it makes sense for Pathfinder. Totally makes sense. Honestly, the GM screen for Pathfinder, I hope they change it up for 2nd edition. Because it's useful, and I still use it, but... they could have done so much better with that. And then when they've kept putting new ones out with different art on the outside, but left the inside the same, it broke my heart a little bit. First of all, I want the GM screen landscape, not tall, because I like to be able to see and reach over it easy. And ever since I got landscape GM screens for 3.5 edition and then 4th edition's GM screen landscape and 5th edition's GM landscape, I do not understand why they don't do landscape, because I think it's just straight up the superior option. And I know they have reasons that they say that it's harder to fit things on it, but I still think it's the superior option.
So I'm tall, and I traditionally played with, for whatever reason, very tall players. Like, I am the third tallest person in my old group, and so a landscape GM screen just makes me feel exposed.
Oh. Like, I want there to be I'm not one of those GMs that likes to roll everything out in the open and have nothing between me and the players. Now, I appreciate the utility of a GM screen to hide my notes, hide the miniatures I'm about to throw out there, to be able to roll in secret. I take full advantage of all of that stuff and I enjoy having the reference material, but I do not like when it's this big shield that hides me from the nose down from my players. I did appreciate how the lower GM screens made it much easier for me to reach the miniatures and reach over onto the map, and also opened more of me up to the players. It didn't feel quite as like I'm just sitting here unseen, like the Wizard of Oz narrating the adventure to my players.
Pay no attention to the nerd behind the cardboard curtain.
Well, I prefer portrait, but I also just said that I don't even use my GM screen anymore. So do not take what my preference is in mind when they are designing this new product. You are the customer that they want to please. Mm-hmm. All right. I will just want to say one thing about the Ennies and the fact that no Pathfinder products were nominated. Mm-hmm. There is a very good chance that this is Paizo's design, that they just did not submit any Pathfinder products for nomination for a couple of reasons. One, they don't want to cannibalize the votes. They don't want to have Starfinder running against Pathfinder, because that could split the vote since they are similar and they have they appeal to a similar type of judge. Two, Pathfinder can already say it is an Ennia winning product, but Starfinder cannot, since the core rulebook is up for these Ennies. So, and three, Pathfinder First Edition is on its way out, mm-hmm. and so they don't need to be, what was your? I was trying to reference the expression you got wrong earlier, and I don't.
I actually got the expression right. Actually,
Over-gild
the lily, or gilding the lily, to adorn unnecessarily something that is already beautiful and perfect.
So there we go. They don't need to over-gild the lily of Pathfinder. It's time to gild the lily of Starfinder. Mm-hmm. Not over-gild it, just gild it enough. Mm-hmm.
Yep, I can get it, totally.
Are we ready to wrap things up?
We are ready to wrap this up.
We will be right back with wrap-ups and shout-outs right after this.
And we're back.
Thank you for joining us for episode 181 of No Direction, the Pathfinder News, Reviews, and Interviews podcast. Before we go, there are a couple of things I want to shout out to, but I also want to talk about Cosmic Power says in chat that Paizo did, in fact, not submit any Pathfinder products except the Inner Sea Taverns and a PFS scenario.
Hmm.
Cosmic Power, can you give me a source for that information? Because, anyone can make that claim. I'm just curious where you got that information. Interesting that Inner Sea Taverns might be the one that makes the cut. Hmm. And PFS scenarios, I believe it... there we go. Mm-hmm. Any awards stuck? Oh, there's actually a list of the ones that were submitted. I didn't realize that. That's interesting. Cool. So I'm not going to research it down at this point. You've provided a source. I believe you, Cosmic Power. Why do you think Inner Sea Taverns? Do you have that book?
I haven't read it yet. I have it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, of course you have it. All right. I never even thought to pick it up. It just... didn't seem like a book I'd want, but if it was one of the ones that they thought was worth it, I might have to go back and look at that. Mm-hmm. And then a PFS scenario. Yeah, the PFS scenarios never get their due.
don't know. And honestly, we just did an episode on this for Starfinder, but the Starfinder Society scenarios, the PFS has always been secretly awesome. And Starfinder Society might secretly be the best part of Starfinder because they do so great with those adventures and taking advantage of the fact that that game is like aping episodic 90s sci-fi. So that's the perfect format to have episodic 90s sci-fi adventures.
All right, so now actual shoutouts. First one is a Kickstarter. It is the Magic Description Cards for writers, storytellers, and GMs. Yeah. I am not shouting out to this because it's a good product as much as I am because I believe in the people that are running it. It's Conflict Games. They are the ones that released Conflict, which was the PvP adaptation of the Pathfinder role-playing game. We were big fans of Conflict when it... Okay, well, the revised version that came out. Mm-hmm. And I am interested in this product. So it's not that I am for or against it. Like I said, I'm shouting out more because it's the company that I'm getting behind. I am intrigued by this, and I do want to know where it's going. So there's 23 days left to go. They are basically at their goal. But if you want to check it out, so Magic Description Cards for writers, storytellers, and GMs. It's over 100 cards with over 600 system-neutral phrases to help depict fantasy fiction magic.
And the play just seemed pretty easy. To get the deck of cards, it's only $25, so that's cool.
Yeah, and $25 the art bucks looks for a really, deck of 100 cards.
The art is really impressive, and the layout is nice, so... if they look like they're good looking cards, they're also tarot sized.
Yes. So it's a good handful.
Yeah. This might, when does this Kickstarter end? I might have to get in on this. 23 days.
And yeah.
Okay.
Next up, Design Finder. So Design Finder, we mentioned it, I believe last episode.
Mm-hmm.
We are not giving it as much attention as we gave to RPG Superstar, which is, you know, this is the spiritual successor of RPG Superstar. The reason is just timing. We are so preoccupied with PaizoCon coverage, upcoming Gen Con coverage.
Mm-hmm. Are we working on 4 podcasts?
Yes. So I don't want people to take this as a slight against Design Finder. I appreciate this. I have not read the entries. Sorry, not the entries, but the results for round 2. They have been posted. This is design an encounter location, an adventure location.
Mm-hmm.
When I have the time, I'm looking forward to diving into this. I don't want to half report on it and not have the information to properly give it its due. So this is a shout out, not a news item. If you are interested in RPG Superstar, if you were a fan of RPG Superstar, if you are interested in the process of designing and... you know, if you are interested in at all ever becoming a designer, I recommend you check it out. And I also recommend we had 2-part series on our blogs. One part was written by Randall last week, and then one was written by Luis. Randall wrote, he offered the item that he submit, and then his designer notes, and then Luis gave him developer notes of why he thought maybe that item could have been stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I'll give a shout out to another podcast that I've been enjoying quite a bit lately, the Board Game Design Lab podcast. So it is board game specific. There's very rarely do they talk about RPGs, but the host, his name is Gabe, I forget his last name. One thing that he is passionate about is getting out there, being productive, finding ways to be more productive. And he will often have sections of any interview where he was just talking about people's process and not just like a creative process, but a productivity process. And his most recent episode was all about things he's learned from non-gamers about productivity. And if you are someone that is like, I want to get into this stuff or I want to be creative, and yet I never seem to find the time or never seems to amount to anything, this is a great conversation about focusing those energies, making sure you don't just have ideas, but goals and plans. I highly recommend it, the Board Game Design Lab podcast. It is at boardgamedesignlab.com.
I need to binge this, considering we're going to be filming RPG Design Club this week.
I have been binging it. It is quite good. I wish I'd gotten into it earlier, because there's over 100 episodes, and at this point I just want to read them all, or not read them all, listen to them all. Mm-hmm. But I know that if I like go back to back with a few of them, then I don't digest them as well. Like, I get the most out of this when I listen to one and then just listen to nothing for a while and just stew in my thoughts.
Mm-hmm. All right. Is that everything?
That's everything on my list.
Okay. Oh, I do want to, on a similar note, I want to shout out to a YouTube channel that is super popular. They don't need my shout out, but it's incredibly valuable information, and that is Extra Credits. If you've not heard of this, Ryan, you know Extra Credits, right?
I love Extra Credit.
It is so good. It's mostly focused on video games, but so much of it is applicable to all sorts of gamings and all sorts of business models. And also they have a sort of like a historical side where it's more about history and not about gaming. And as a role player, knowing all of that history, like I just watched their series, a 5-part series on why paper money exists. And that will inform so much of what I do when I'm starting to work on how a city's economy works in a game, and to know why these different things. I mean, there's just adventure ideas that you could have with just because how promissory notes came into being, and the fact that the person that invented them had to run for his life to another country on 2 occasions, and that in itself could be a fun adventure. Go check out that YouTube page if you've not checked it out. It's amazing.
Yeah, I can give a specific example of something that I've applied to my game design. They were talking about how, from a designer's point of view, you might have, like, when you level up, you do go from like 15 damage to 20 damage. And from the designer's point of view, it's like, that is a big difference. You've gone up a certain percentage. You've gone to like 33% of damage output. But if everyone's hit points are such that it still takes 2 hits to kill them, then to a player, nothing has happened when they leveled up, even though you know that the math has improved. And so it's important to look at an option, and it's like, what is this doing to the play experience? Mm-hmm. Until next time, I'm Ryan Costello.
And I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param.
And if you want to find the path, you need no direction.